Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Over you. Here's another story we've been following this week. A judge in Georgia sentenced 30-year-old Raquel Nelson to a year of probation and 40 hours of community service after she was convicted of vehicular homicide. Nelson's 4-year-old son was killed in a hit and run back in April 2010. Nelson was held partially responsible because she and her children were jaywalking. Now, the story has lit up the blogosphere, particularly blogs that promote smart urban growth and public transportation. We'll hear why in a moment, but first, some background. Nelson is a single mother. She's also a part-time student, and she can't afford a car. So she uses the bus to get from her apartment in suburban Atlanta to downtown and other places. On April 10, 2010, she was out with her 3 kids celebrating a birthday. And as they were making their way to the stop to take the bus home, they just missed it. The next bus arrived an hour later. And so by the time they got home, it was way past the kids' bedtime. And what happened next? Here's Michelle Wirth, a reporter with WABE in Atlanta.
They got off the bus, which is directly across the street from her apartment complex, and her and her 3 children, it was getting dark. She wanted to get them home as quickly as possible because they weren't used to being out after dark. So she did what she said a lot of neighbors in her community do, which was she crossed from where the bus stop was located to a median in the center of the 4-lane state roadway. And she says that's when her son ran into the road and she ran after him. And she, her son, and her youngest daughter were then struck by the hit-and-run driver, and her son died of injuries from the accident.
The driver had been drinking. He was partially blind and had a criminal record. When police finally caught him, he ended up spending just 6 months in jail. But prosecutors in Cobb County, Georgia, also charged Raquel Nelson with endangering her children. Now, Nelson's apartment complex is directly across the street from the bus stop, a bus stop that primarily serves that complex. But the nearest crosswalk is a third of a mile away.
Does a person's skin color determine who you might stop for at a crosswalk?
It does. At least that's the conclusion made by a couple of researchers at Portland State University. Eileen Park joins us more live now with the latest on this. That's kind of disturbing, Eileen.
It is a bit strange, Jeff, but we're not talking about overt racism. We're talking about the kind of subtle bias that we're hardly even aware of. After this story, you might look at crosswalks a little differently.
Male and female, black and white. Researchers chose a group of 12 pedestrians broken down by those categories to examine if drivers were behaving differently at crosswalks. The men involved in the study were similar in height and weight. So were the women. And when they walked across this crosswalk on Southeast Belmont and 14th in Portland, they wore the same outfits as well.
Drivers were less likely to stop for our black pedestrians compared to white pedestrians, as well as less likely to stop for our male pedestrians compared to female pedestrians.
This conclusion didn't surprise her. She pulled data from the CDC showing racial minorities were dying more frequently from crash-related pedestrian deaths than others.
Man is in custody after Oakland police connected him with a deadly hit-and-run crash. 64-year-old Timothy Hamano of Piedmont is charged with vehicular manslaughter. He's accused of hitting and killing 41-year-old Gregory Turnage on Park Boulevard near Greenwood Avenue back in May. Police say Hamano's car veered off the road and hit Turnage. They say Hamano ran from the scene, leaving not only the victim behind, but also his injured wife in his car.
He is just 18 years old, facing a possible double life sentence for the senseless murder of a man he never knew. Daryl Dedman is thin, short, with straggly blonde hair, accused of leading a group of white teenage revelers on a mission to find and beat up anyone who is black.
They discussed, let's be honest here, let's go get a nigger, right?
That's exactly what it will show.
They drove 16 miles on a freeway heading west. At 5 a.m. that Sunday morning, the teens in two vehicles took the Ellis Avenue off-ramp, leading to a predominantly black section of Jackson. Just as they were exiting, an unsuspecting 49-year-old auto worker named James Craig Anderson was standing by his car at this local motel, and he was black. So literally, they found the first black person they could find, and that black person was in this parking lot.
Well, yes, this is the first business that you get to coming off of the highway. And so that was the first person that apparently was out here and vulnerable.
According to witness statements, at first James Craig Anderson was beaten and taunted with racial slurs. Surveillance video shows white teens going back and forth in what prosecutors say was a continuous beating of the victim. As one of the teens walks back to the cars after beating Anderson, he pumps his fist in the air and shouts, "White power," according to a motel security guard. Then some of the teens got in the white SUV and drove away, leaving Anderson beaten and lying on the ground. Daryl, Dedman apparently wasn't through. He had two girls in his truck as he was leaving this parking lot, a big F-250 pickup truck. James Craig Anderson, the man who was beaten almost to a pulp, was stumbling down this curb. That's when police say Daryl Dedman hit the gas, jumped the curb, and ran right over his victim, smashing him. Here you see James Craig Anderson in a hotel parking lot as he first comes into view in the lower right corner of the screen. This is after he was beaten, according to law enforcement officials. He staggers into the headlights of Mr. Dedman's truck. The truck backs up and surges forward suddenly, running right over the defenseless man. Take a look again as the approaching headlights glow on Anderson's shirt, then disappears under the truck. According to police, Dedman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's, meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over. I ran that nigger over.
Woo! Context of white supremacy. For Reals, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, July 26, 2021. So I have been told. Might not survive 2021. I said that before, in a year where I said there was a shooting in front of my house, and even other victims of white supremacy laughed at me and did not take me seriously. Wow, this has been like the worst year ever, where every single day is just painful, agonizing terrorism and racism all day long, unrelenting. Absolutely amazing. Gus T. Renegade might not survive 2021. This has absolutely been the most demoralizing year I can think of. Woo! I can't even say we're persevering. We're just here. The place might blow up. Anything might happen. Before we finish the broadcast, we'll just see if we can get through. My headphones broke, to be specific. My external sound card broke right as we were getting ready to broadcast. Like, what? And this is like $14. This is not one of those, "Oh, woe is me, we're broke, this is the two." Like a $10 piece of plastic. That is very critical to doing the broadcast. Like, woo! Get through as we may. The broadcast for today, recommended by one of our investors who is with us for the retreat back in Virginia. Not good days either. His career field, area of interest, public safety, civic engineering, how they design all of these wonderful cities and sidewalks and roadways that we take for granted each and every day as we go up and down the road or whatever we're doing, going from point A to point B. And he recommended the book that we're going to talk about for today's broadcast and how it relates to racism, white supremacy. We've been talking about a lot of these issues for a long time on the cows. This is not my area of expertise by any area of a long stride, but wow, so much of it was so painfully familiar once I started reading. Just for listeners, if this had not been such a traumatizing, and I mean every hour of every day, traumatizing year, I would have easily had one more segment in our introduction featuring Irie, where just last year at the beginning of the pandemic, she talked about a black mother with her children, young children, in a stroller, and how it was a car of white people and they were revving the accelerator while she was in the crosswalk. That's a big one, because they say, oh, you're jaywalking and all the rest. She was in the crosswalk and they were revving the accelerator, seemingly to threaten this black mother with her child in the stroller. That would have been included in the report, but hey, we included a lot as we were rolling. Incidentally, in that segment, you also heard the report Portland State University about takes longer for dark people to get across the crosswalk. That report is old enough that Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, we talked about that because she lived in Washington, D.C. And she said, man, they encourage all this bike riding and all the rest of it. Like, ooh, are we going to be safe for black cyclists, black pedestrians? Anywho, that was Daryl Dedman at the end. I think a lot of folks, that's 10 years. It's 10 years since this summer when that happened. Daryl Dedman, James Craig Anderson. That's a household name, right? Black male privilege. Yeah, yeah. We'll get to our guest for today's broadcast. In addition to writing the book that we will discuss, well-respected expert. She has published a number of reports in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and National Public Radio. She is the founder and principal of 3MPH Planning and Consulting, a firm focused on pedestrian safety. Her book, which came out last year in the middle of the pandemic, which I love. She even has a note at the beginning talking about, wow, we would have included some different things if we had known what we, you know, were come to know, find out during the whole past 18 months or so. But her book, Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Very, very interesting material. We'll try to cover as much as we can. Joining us live, Miss Amy Schmidt. Miss Schmidt, are you with us?
Yes. Hi. It's Angie.
Angie, my apologies. Been a long day.
Yeah, no problem.
Angie Schmidt.
No problem.
Strive for accuracy. Angie Schmidt, thank you so much. Angie Schmidt, author of Right of Way. For our listeners, I'm sure for some folks this is their first time hearing about your book, the work that you do. Any info that you'd like to share with folks to help us get started?
Yeah, so this is a problem. I set out trying to explain this problem we're having in the United States. And in the past 10 years, we've seen about a 50% increase in pedestrian deaths. So I was a reporter that was reporting on transportation issues for a long time, and I always thought this was a big injustice, in part because it's related to inequality. It is related to racism and sort of other isms we have in our society where certain people's sort of safety is disregarded for other people who are a little more privileged, their sort of convenience and access.
Interesting. Interesting. Other isms. You are a white woman, Angie Schmidt. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right.
Awesome. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term white supremacy and the term racism as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that definition is accurate? Do you think such a system exists?
I mean, yes, definitely. So I think that racism, white supremacy, yes, is one of the fundamental sort of organizing principles in our society, in the United States. And I said other isms too, because I think, you know, sexism is a little like that, homophobia, ableism. There's all these different ways, and these are ways we've organized society, and we're making snap judgments. We're all sort of taught a little bit. We're all taught subconsciously from a young age a lot of this stuff about who's sort of matters. And I do think yes, definitely. And it comes out in this problem. And I think as we're recognizing more and more, almost all public health problems can be tied to racism and racial inequality and white supremacy. Yes.
Much obliged. And this is one we at the Cows, I've said for almost a year now. It's crazy. We've been on the air for about 12 and a half years. And I've been saying for a year now, white guests only, trying to learn about the problem of racism, white supremacy, and how to get this thing solved as soon as possible. I've just concluded you can learn a lot more from white people than the victims, non-white people, of racism, white supremacy. This is one I try to encourage all of our white guests to be as honest as possible. That's a big part of racism, white supremacy, where white people are very dishonest when speaking about racism, white supremacy, especially when speaking with non-white people. Being honest, even if you don't agree with something, that's totally fine, because we have, you know, I don't agree with anything or all of the concepts or ideas that anybody has to bring forth about this problem. So if you don't agree, that's fine. But just being honest and not using, unnecessary words to answer questions. That's another one where white people will not answer questions, but they will use lots of words, being very verbose in not answering the question. So to be specific, when you said there are other isms, I perked up. And then when you gave your answer where you gave a definitive yes, system of white supremacy, yes, definition is correct. You said that there are other isms, and you said that homophobia is a little like that. You missed in sexism. Some of these other, I guess, systems of oppression is what people will commonly say. I want to be very explicit here. When I say system of white supremacy, there is nothing like that on the planet. Not at all, not even close. And in my view, that is a part of the deception when people compare racism, white supremacy, to sexism or homophobia. And I'll be specific. We had a white guest on just a few weeks ago, and he said black people are treated like dogs. And we were talking in the context of Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm sure you've seen that. We've talked 100 years, and oh my God, this is terrible, and maybe 300 casualties and all the rest. Lied about the casualties, too. It wasn't until they found the mass grave that it was acceptance that, wow, it might have been 300 black people killed in this event. He said, our white guest, that black people are treated like dogs. And I said, that's not true. Can you name an event where white people in mobs went out and killed hundreds of dogs at one time and bragged about it and then repeated this over and over and over? And he said, no, I have to retract that. So I pose it to you. Can you think of one instance where a group of individuals went and slaughtered an entire town of people because they said, you all are homophobic, or you all are homosexuals, or queer, or gay, or whatever? Can you think of one time where that's happened in the continental U.S.?
Well, I'm not trying to say that the two things are the same. I'm trying to compare it. I'm just trying to say those are, you know, we're taught some things about people's position in our society, those kind of that people have, and it's sort of part of I don't mean to equate white supremacy and racism with other kinds of discrimination, but to say you mentioned I'm like 100% and an expert on racism. I just wrote a book that sort of attempts to explain a single phenomenon is related to racism. So where I can sort of be useful is explaining this one phenomenon, but I really don't want to present myself as an expert on racism. I'm not. And so I'm just sort of a sort of issue, which is transportation related. But the thing I'm trying to explain has to
Can I pause right here just for 1 second, Angie Schmidt? Not to interrupt. But this is one where answering the question is important. I do appreciate the additional information, but this is one. If you could answer the question with the additional information. So the question was, since you did say that homophobia is like racism, white supremacy, can you think of one instance where individuals organized to purge an entire city of individuals on the sole basis that they were classified as homosexual?
Not in the same way as this whole not the same way.
Okay. Oh, thank you for
not your... that. I don't know that much about that. It could be. Instances like that I don't know about. I'm not sure. Honestly. It's hard for me to answer definitively. I don't mean to diminish racism and white supremacy, which is obviously huge, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. That is special and different and belongs in maybe a different category.
Okay. Maybe a different category. That didn't sound definitive, but all right. And I appreciate all of this because all of this is very common when we talk to white people, regardless of their field or area of expertise. All of this is very common in saying, hey, there is a system of white supremacy, racism, period. All that other stuff is way, 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 way distant second. Don't even begin to compare that regular or that is not very frequent with white guests. They generally sound similar to the way that you are explaining, which again, I'm asserting for our non-white listeners, that is a part of white supremacy, racism, because they're not being honest about what's happening on the planet. Now we can drill down and get directly to your book. Let me give the title for listeners again, full title, boop, boop. Right of Way Race. And that's always when I drill down on two. That's almost every time. They don't say racism. It'll be race, class, and the silent epidemic of pedestrian deaths in America. Angie Schmidt, right in front of my face. I would have seen it, but whew, victim this week. To get to the specifics, or one more before we get to the specifics of your book on these pedestrian fatalities. And this is so important for your work because you talk so frequently about the sympathy and empathy for these victims. And sometimes it's just not there, especially if the victims are people we don't care about, people we don't value. We had a non-white author. He wrote a report about racism, white supremacy in the publishing industry. And in that report, he was quoted as saying, white people are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I've been asking our white guests over the years, the first portion of his quote, white people are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism. You're a white woman, presumably you have white family members, white friends, you've been around white people for a few decades on the planet. Just your general observation, do you think that a substantial number of individuals classified as white are greatly and sincerely pained by racism?
I don't know, not enough probably.
I think your line might have broken up a little bit. Could you repeat that for me, please? I didn't quite catch it.
Not enough people, white people, and that's correct.
Did you say not enough white people? Just making sure I heard it accurately. Oh, Ms. Schmidt, did you hear me? I just wanted to make sure that I heard you correctly. You said not enough white people are greatly pained about them.
Yeah, okay. It's hard for me to know, you know, what other people think, I guess. But yeah, obviously we're not making enough progress. Not enough is being done.
Okay. You got clear there. Hopefully your volume and everything, clarity will stay right there for the rest of the broadcast. And this, I said I had two, and then we can get to the book and kind of even your expertise in this field, because that's interesting, because we've had some of the other folks who talked about the legacy of the Eisenhower Highway construction during the 1960s and how that also is connected to this problem. That was pretty recent on the program. We talked about, yeah, we'll get to that in 1 second. Before I get to that, one scene that I think people should keep in mind, and I'm not sure if you've seen this movie or not, but it was really popular, and the main actress won an Academy Award, Halle Berry. Do you remember the film Monsters Ball? I guess it's been like 20 years now. Do you remember that film at all?
You know what? I haven't seen that.
Okay, you're not missing anything. You don't need to check it out, anything like that.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
The only reason is that it was really popular. Halle Berry won an Academy Award for her performance, but it also generated a lot of controversy because she has this really graphic sexual scene with Billy Bob Thornton in kind of the middle of the film and what have you, and he's an older white guy and all this, so there was a lot of controversy about it, and it was so graphic, and is this the scene that you really want a black female to win an Academy Award for, type of thing? Before all of the, in fact, this is the way I can set it up, the aphrodisiac, if you will, because literally she's in tears and weeping, grieving for the loss of her son when she and Billy Bob Thornton get, you know, raunchy on the sofa. What is the lead up? Why is she crying? Her son died. How did her son die? Oh, they were walking home. No sidewalk, hit and run, he dies in the hospital. That didn't get as much attention. Her obese black male son, that didn't get as much attention. Him dying, also a graphic scene. You see her in the hospital, hysteric, and they cover him up, and Billy Bob Thornton is there to comfort her, and then later, you know, all that. But I said, wow, that's, they kill her husband, P. Diddy, in the electric chair, then they kill her son, running him over with the car, and then that. That's Monsters Ball. I said, wow, that, for that movie to be so important and to be so talked about, like that scene, just, I'll ask you, you wrote the book right away. This is right in your book. Black child gets run over, hit and run, nothing done about it. Any thoughts on this being a pivotal point in this movie with Halle Berry?
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, this is something that happens to a lot of people, and not even just pedestrian deaths, but traffic deaths in general. And when they're portrayed in the media, it's often that kind of thing where it's just something that happens and it's not dwelled on at all. And I think that affects the way we see the problem. It's never sort of dramatized. Like, for example, a lot of movies will have a high speed chase and everyone sort of walks away unscathed at the end. But the reality, and so that's what people think when they see a high speed chase. But the reality is they often end very badly for a lot of innocent people. Even police chases, for example, hundreds of people are killed every year in police chases, and about a third are innocent bystanders. And that's another area where black people are disproportionately killed, including as innocent bystanders. So there really are very, very high costs to this problem. And we've sort of glossed over it in a lot of our pop culture. And I do think that impacts the problem and the way we view it.
Just based on what you said and how people have responded, like, I don't remember people seeing that film and saying, wow, they just hit that child and ran, like, we need to do something. Like, they're trying to speak to us about pedestrian and child safety with these pedestrian deaths. That's something else that you talk about in the book, and it just kind of gets glossed over, like, eh. Two dead black males. Let's get to dead black child. Yeah, let's just get to the sex
right.
scene. That seems very familiar to the type of response to these deaths that we get to in your book. You specifically, you're not attached to university. We said you're independent and doing your research and what have you. What is your degree in specifically, or, you know, in terms of your education?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can recall, your professors, do you remember along the way, especially in this field, urban planning, transportation, all that, do you recall having any black instructors?
Okay, when I was an undergraduate, I studied, and I also studied political science. I can recall one black male professor at OSU, and he taught politics, he taught ethnic and racial political organizing. And then I had a black urban, so I had a master's degree in urban, and I did have a black man professor. There were two that very famous in city management. I wish I could remember his name. It was like a decade ago. I'd have to look it up, but he was a really, really well-known Italian guy. But not very many, to your point. I can remember two, but there may be others that I have forgotten.
Okay. 10 years is a long time, but you can remember two, best of your recollection. And she said, to the greater point, not very many. It's not like she's forgetting, you know, 20 professors who helped her along the way in this field, urban planning, that sort of thing. Not very many. And that also has a big impact, like many other fields. That's what I mean. System of white supremacy. It's not like this is the first time we've heard that. Oh, really? They don't have a lot of black doctors? Oh, really? They don't have a lot of black teachers? Really? Very common.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem in urban planning, too, and it's been discussed a lot over the last year. The field is too white. I talk about a little bit in my book, the field of traffic engineering, the same problem. Engineering is overwhelmingly white and male. Urban planning is still too white, so that is a big problem. It is a big problem. It's not very representative, and that contributes to this problem where we have bad safety outcomes for Black people, Hispanic folks, and Native people.
Individuals classified as non-white. In your book, Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America, you have the foreword written by a non-white male, black male, Charles T. Brown. Specifically, he writes, early in life, at the nexus of this unwavering fight for justice and truth-telling is the genesis of my appreciation and admiration for my dear sister, Angie Schmidt. I have always known my sister Angie, racialized as white, to commit herself to speaking courageously and unapologetically through multiple platforms about the inequities and injustices facing pedestrians, bicyclists, and transit users along America's roadways. Mr. Ford goes on, but I was struck by that. I said, racialized as white. Maybe we'll get Ms. Schmidt to break that down. What does that mean to be racialized as white? And if you could be specific on this one in terms of what specific behaviors, things did people do to, quote unquote, racialize you as a white person?
You know what? I think he just wanted to point out. I don't know why he used that verbiage exactly, but I think he just wanted to point out that I'm a white woman. I don't even know how I would explain that, I guess. But you know, my family, going back a few generations, mostly comes from Europe, and I think, you know, a lot of the part of the sort of dominant culture in the United States and certain privileges that come with that.
Do you recall in this program that I had already asked you if you are a white woman?
Yes.
Okay. So we already had that on the record. I wouldn't need to bring that up again. I was curious because I don't use that verb specifically. Racialized, that's not really in my daily, you know, vernacular. So I don't really know what that means in terms of specific things. And that's why I said specific, like what specific behaviors, like is this like, I'm assuming maybe we're talking about like your white parents, white teachers, white family members, white friends, white neighbors, like what specific, because I think this is important. This is what I mean. Sometimes the language is not enough detail to really grasp what we're talking about. What do you, or I guess Mr. Ford, can you help us understand what he means? You were racialized as white. What does that mean specifically?
So his name is Charles Brown, actually. And I sort of don't want to answer for him. It's his wording, and I would be guessing, and I just don't feel comfortable putting words in his mouth like that.
Okay. It says Charles T. Brown in the, I have the ebook, so maybe it was, I have Charles T. Brown. Anyway.
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry, you said Ford. You said Ford, so I just wanted to clarify. But, I mean, he might be a good guest for you sometime. He's really... Anyway,
white guests only. White guests. So I think I said that before, too. That's fine if you don't want to speak to his words, but I mean, you said that you are a white person. We can, you know, bump that aside. You can just help us understand that. How did you learn what that means? There we go. We can move that to the side completely, and I can still get the same question. So how did you learn what that means in a functional sense?
I'm just not 100% sure what you're asking. Can you explain a little bit more, like, how did I learn what it means to be a white person in the United
yes,
States?
Ma'am.
Or, like, how do I sort of realize over my life what that means,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
for me? That's mm-hmm. that's the question? Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So... I've always been interested in these kind of issues since I was, even back in high school, but I don't think I've always, you know, understood it perfectly my whole life, you know, and I obviously I'm a person that went to undergraduate and graduate school and spends a lot of time reading and writing. So, and I've done a lot of reading about racism, and I think it's really important to understanding our culture and our history. But like I said, there's people that have much more expertise on this. I don't present myself as an expert, but anyway, my own position, I can give you an example. I can't pinpoint one day in my life where I, you know, sort of recognized my own privilege because of being white. Is that what you're saying?
I definitely have not used the word privilege on this broadcast. The restate would just be you learning what does it mean to be white? How did you learn that growing up and what that means in a functional sense? Yes.
So, yeah, no one ever talked to me about that when I was growing up. There definitely wasn't like, I wasn't getting official training where people said this is the way white people behave, you know, at least not openly. I don't know. There was definitely I'm sorry, you caught me kind of off guard. I need to think about it. I don't have a good answer to that.
I'm just pointing that out for listeners. That's interesting because she said she's white and she didn't have any ambiguity when we asked her that, what seems like a long time ago at the beginning of the program. I would just say it's interesting. I generally don't have an experience of asking a plumber, let's say. You're a plumber? Yes. What does that mean in a functional sense? For them to say, let me sit down and think on that for a minute. Like, that's significant. Curious, noteworthy. I could put many descriptors on that one. We will come back to that. And I say all the time, it is totally allowable to take time to think. No problem. We'll put a pen and come back. Getting to the book specifically, words come up in this book so frequently. I said, man, Angie Schmidt, she should be feeling at least some of our concepts about the importance of words, because that comes up in the book so frequently. Let me pick out one of the better ones in the text, jaywalking. This is one that I totally took for granted in terms of never thinking of the etymology. Like, where does this term come from? The concept of jaywalking. Let me read a great one here about this. Let's see. There were so many where I was just stunned. Oh, let's see. Oh, there's so many. Accident and jaywalk. Let me see if I can find one of the great ones for jaywalking, if I get my footnotes together, because I think a lot of folks have not thought about this concept. Let's see. So she has a whole chapter 3, on blaming the victim. And I guess that maybe you can give us, within this concept of jaywalking, you talk about how previously, before Ford takes over and everybody has a car and all this, pedestrians, hey, cross where you want to. Pedestrians have the whole road. You can fly out. You don't have to cross the corner and all that. But all of this was deliberately changed. And that includes even the creation of the term jaywalking. Can you give us some of that context, Ms. Schmidt?
Yeah, so there's this other author named Peter Norton that wrote a really interesting book that looks at the early history of the auto era in the United States. So that's like the 20s and the 30s, and that maybe even a little bit the 40s. But prior to that era, like you said, there was no pedestrians had free roam. Streets take up a lot of space in cities, and prior to that, they were viewed just as a public space. And kids would play in them, and people could cross wherever they wanted, and merchants would sell goods in them. And, you know, they were sort of an extension of the city. But then when cars started coming into cities in a big way in the 20s and 30s, when Ford, like you said, brought in a Model T Ford, and car use starts becoming more popular. And again, at this time, it was wealthier people primarily that were drivers, and they started killing people in cities in a big way. Cities like Philadelphia and Baltimore and Cleveland, where I live, they were, you know, almost entirely pedestrianized at that time, or there was some use of streetcars and some bicycles. But for the most part, people were using walking to get around. So all of a sudden, thousands of cars start flooding into cities, and people started getting killed. And overwhelmingly, they were children. So there was a lot of outcry about it. And in response, there was sort of this organized lobbying campaign that included auto sellers and a lot of aligned auto interests, gas dealers, and they coined this term jaywalking. And like you said, the term jay at the time in the old fashioned, in the terms of the time was an insulting term. It was a little bit like calling somebody, I don't even know what that, like sort of like a hillbilly or some, so it was a slight, that was meant to sort of insult someone. So, they attached that term to it, and they had a campaign to discourage it, and they were able to get it enacted into laws. And now it's fundamental to the way we think about sort of who streets are for and how they operate, and most importantly, who's at fault if something bad happens, if someone is hurt.
That's something that I also thought was hugely important in terms of the whole chapter, blaming the victim. And you talk about that when they have media reports about a pedestrian being struck, and again, disproportionately non-white people, non-white males, poor people, saying, man, they were at fault. You didn't cross at the intersection, or he was entirely, didn't look both ways, didn't make eye contact with the driver, was wearing dark clothing. Right. Somehow it's the pedestrian. You got what you deserve. Should have been looking, should have been paying attention, got what you deserve.
Right.
Where, wait a minute, you're talking about a pedestrian where, you know, let's say you've eaten a lot of McDonald's. Maybe you're 200 pounds, maybe. A vehicle, you could be talking about an F-150. You could be talking about something that's several tons. Like, wait a minute, since there's such a differential, shouldn't there be a greater responsibility that since I could kill someone, maybe I should be a little more cautious about watching out for these folks?
Yeah. That's one of the points I try to make. It is kind of bizarre how often even traffic safety officials imply that pedestrians and drivers have sort of equal responsibility, even though, you know, we agree, like, to operate a car, you need a license. We don't require very much, but you do have to have special training. You have to have this government license. And then anyone, you know, anyone can walk in, you know, children, even when the victims are children, oftentimes the knee-jerk reaction is to blame them, or failing that, if they're young, then they blame the mother or the parents.
Blaming the parent. We heard Raquel Nelson. We heard a little bit of that report at the beginning. She takes up a big report in your book, or a big chapter in your book, Black Mom Blamed for Her Child Being Hit by a Drunk Driver. What does that moron say all the time? He says sobriety would be best. Yeah. But back to the bling that all the time, you're a pedestrian, you're at fault. If you get hit, it's your fault. And you said that the language, and we pay a lot of attention to language. I hope some of that has come through just in the first portion of our discussion, definition of racism and all that. Words are critical in how we think about that part of this problem, how we think about and understand things. They started off, you write, oh, this, how could I not highlight this? More important is that reporters rarely ask if there was even a crosswalk anywhere nearby. In Salazar's case, it is not clear from media accounts exactly where he was struck, but on State Highway 49 or Tyrone Street, where he was killed, crosswalks are about one-third of a mile apart. By repeating the "not in the crosswalk" statement without studying the context, the reporter sidesteps question of whether the road itself offered sufficient pedestrian infrastructure and misses an opportunity to tie Salazar's death to wider systemic failures. And just going one more, because this is in the language and I see this so consistently, I thought this was so important. I hope this is not minutia for people listening, but again, words are important. Our guest, Angie Schmidt, writes, Mangason found that almost all the media accounts of pedestrian deaths used a few different syntactic and grammatical cues that subtly placed blame on the victims, again, mostly non-white people. For example, almost every account, all but three, used the passive voice to describe the events. A pedestrian was hit by a car, rather than driver hits pedestrian. In this way, almost every account distanced the driver from the act, she wrote. In addition, in nearly every case, reporters avoided constructing the events so that the driver was the agent of violence. Mangason found 33 accounts named the vehicle rather than the driver as the source of injuries. For example, pedestrian hit by a car. Even in the case of drunk, what did that moron say? He said, sobriety would be best. Continuing, even in the case of drunk driving, the driver was never directly associated with active verbs of death or violence, suggesting that regardless of culpability, there is resistance to associating drivers with the violence of traffic incidents. Not accidents, that's a whole nother topic. Can you give us a little more detail? Because I think this is so important.
Yeah, sure. So there is a tendency to, in the media accounts, and I used to be a newspaper reporter, that this is very common. When there is a lot of reporting on traffic crashes that's very superficial, if there's a fatality, they might report the name, they might not, they report the location where it occurred. Usually they're sort of just reading off, they're sort of reporting from a police report. But very often that there's language that, again, reflexively sort of blames the victims in these cases. And that use of "wasn't in the crosswalk" is a big one. Sometimes that case, the Salazar case, I can't remember the first name offhand, I'm sorry, but that was a gentleman who was either 79 or 80, if I remember correctly. And there's three different media accounts that all describe him as running or darting into traffic. So this is a guy that's almost 80, and none of the reporters stopped and said, you know, he's an 80-year-old man. How fast can he be moving? And in his case, he was hit by a police officer. So there, oftentimes the reporting is very superficial, and there's no real reporting happening. They're just repeating what happens in these police reports. And oftentimes the end result is for people to, you know, they read it. This is someone who died, and they sort of shrug their shoulders and blame them and move on. So I think that's one of the reasons we haven't been able to make progress on this.
Nobody's culpable, or in fact, the people who are culpable, they got what they deserve. They're either dead or mangled in the hospital or whatever it is. If that's the way that we look at this, then no, we're not going to make any progress. We're just going to get getting bigger cars and driving faster and all the rest. I don't want to minimize, though, because I see this in terms of using language that places blame on the victim, removes culpability from even the driver if they're under the influence and all the rest of it. They're not blamed. We use a passive voice, so it's not like someone is responsible for this. The car did it, maybe that sort of thing. I see that exact same passive, deceptive language of obfuscation with racism, white supremacy. And it's the exact same effect. They will say it is the, we have legacies of racial bias and, you know, we have vestiges. That's one of the, somebody got a raise for that one. Vestiges of Jim Crow and vestiges of disgust. All these types of ways where it doesn't make it that, no. There are white people right now who are responsible for why racism, white supremacy is currently happening. Does it make sense what I'm saying? Is it logical, Ms. Schmidt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Context of white supremacy, trying to use logic. In the same chapter, words are so important. We talk about that on the program all the time. The same segment, you talk about the word, or I'll give them the subtitle of this chapter, tragic accidents. Man, words are so important. I could say that a billion times. Read a little bit. Although much of the media coverage around the issue of pedestrian deaths has been harmful, a hopeful shift has begun. Activists for bicyclists and pedestrians in New York especially have campaigned for years to change the way traffic crashes are described. Transportation Alternatives, an advocacy group, and Families for Safe Streets, a group founded by grieving New York City families who lost loved ones in traffic, have led the change to drop the euphemistic term accident and replace it with a more neutral crash or collision. People from the field of traffic safety have been complaining about the term accident in the United States since the 1940s. William Haddon, the first head of the then called National Highway Safety Agency, formed in 1970, deplored the term, according to Baron Lerner, a professor of public health at New York University. He believed it made automobile crashes sound inevitable and, by implication, not preventable, Lerner wrote in his 2011 book, One for the Road. Today, however, thanks to efforts like those from Transportation Alternatives, we are seeing a framing shift. In 2013, the police department changed the name of its Accident Investigation Squad to the more neutral Collision Investigation Squad. In the past, the term accident has sometimes given the inaccurate impression or connotation that there is no fault or liability associated with a specific event, said Ray Kelly, the city's police commissioner, in announcing the changes. I'll stop there. We've heard some people who say, hey man, people like this Schmidt character, you all are just nitpicking and culture police and political correctness and wham, all the rest. I mean, it's an accident. That's all it is. What is all this to do? Collision, accident, and all the rest of it. Why is this such a big deal?
Yeah, so it does. It's a big deal because a lot of people are killed this way in the United States. So we usually have almost 40,000 deaths a year. And that's a pretty bad outcome. There's sort of an attitude that's inevitable. But if we were to do in the United States, if we could do as well as Canada on a per capita base for traffic crashes, about half as many people would die. So we could save about 20,000 lives a year almost if we could just do as well as Canada. And if we could do as well as some, European nations and some Asian nations that are real leaders, we would only have a fourth as many people killed. So we could save as many as 30,000 lives a year if we took this more seriously. So that's why it's so important. Like, the terms that sort of lull us into complacency about this can have the impact of people dying that we could potentially save. And some of the policies we could enact that could save a lot of lives are as simple as requiring more safety technology in cars. There's certain studies, like I cited a study recently that I read about, where there's groups of experts that predict we could save 10,000 lives a year if we were requiring vehicle technology that already exists that's helpful for safety, but we just aren't requiring it. Instead, we're saving a little bit of money on every car. That's what the powers that be have decided is the priority.
Need for speed. Go, go, go. Rush, rush, rush. You even, I think, if I got my information correct, you in the book pointed out, in terms of if we're really talking about efficiency of point A to point B, the best predictor is stops. So as long as you don't have to do a lot of stopping, slowing down for pedestrians doesn't really have much of an impact in terms of, oh my gosh, now a trip that used to take me 20 minutes is going to take 5 hours. Not the case. Just slowing down a little bit for pedestrians doesn't really have that much of a negative impact. Is that accurate?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, when you're driving in the city or the suburbs, as opposed to on the highway, speeding really doesn't help you get where you're going a whole lot faster, because what really determines your journey time is how long and how often you're stopped. So how long you're stopped at a red light, for example, or how long you're sort of held up in congestion. Not when you're trying to speed around a city, you're just kind of wasting gas because you end up stopping so frequently. And even on the highway, it's sort of surprising how far you have to travel when you're speeding for it to add up to any real time savings. In the meantime, you know, speeding is really dangerous. I think you know, we've sort of forgotten that in the United States, but there's sort of a physics equation where the force of a collision increases and it's not even linear. So just a few miles per hour can make a huge difference in survival odds. So anyway, we have this time savings, right, that we're also focused on. But the amount of when we have crashes, right, people lose working years, people are killed. The time that is associated with that, so it dwarfs the amount of time saving we get from speeding, if that makes sense. So it's a really bad trade-off, you know, like maybe you kill yourself for years trying to speed around your town and you're saving a few minutes, but if you get in one serious crash and you're laid up in a hospital for a few weeks, which is something that happens really frequently in the United States, all that time savings is gone and worse.
Context of white supremacy, just slow it down. We heard a Cal's investor said that I generally am not rushing around and pedal to the metal and need for that's generally not white knuckle clenching the steering wheel, not doing all that. Try to get up on time so I can get to work early, not have to speed and run over someone's child in the name of saving a few minutes. Before we get to some of our folks with questions, I had to get this one in with the subtitle, like, wow, this is what I was doing. I have to tell Angie Schmidt, I don't think she knows I am in Seattle. So it was quite a hoot for me, being someone who brags on Seattle all the time and says this is the best plantation. I don't call it a city because we are in the system of white supremacy, but this is the best plantation in the continental U.S. by far. It's not even close. After this past week where I got to go out and explore some of the beaches that I had not even seen in Seattle and reading your book, now I'm really obnoxious about it. Like all the other plantations cities in the continental U.S., in my opinion, they were built for and by peasants in compared to Seattle. And I could even point to her book now and be like, see, look at that, look at that. Like, let me get to the part I wanted to read, and then we can talk about. And I lived in Atlanta,
Now I've been in Seattle. Are you flipping kidding? I would not trade Atlanta for Seattle on my worst day. Like, get out of here. Let's see. The dark appeal of the SUV. Whew. Words are important. And this was written before the pandemic. I read this yesterday on the beach in Seattle, and I bothered all the folks who were sitting next to me. Like, what is wrong with that black guy? Is he going crazy? I was like, look at this. Read this. This was before the pandemic. She writes, Angie Schmidt, like, whoo, she was clairvoyant. One of the early critics of SUVs, former New York Times Detroit Bureau Chief Keith Bradshaw, has said that the same features that kill pedestrians help automakers sell cars. They should have added, in my opinion, to white people, and it would have been accurate. Bradshaw, author of the 2002 book High and Mighty, wrote that with SUVs, automakers tapped into primitive subconscious human impulses. Those were not always so magnanimous. One of the pioneering minds of the SUV industry, Bradshaw wrote, was marketing savant named Clotaire Rapie. His ideas about Americans' base desires helped shape marketing and vehicle design at Chrysler in the 1990s. Rapie's theory was that Americans are terrified of crime. O.J. Simpson and the Bronco was... Anyway, Rapie's theory was that Americans are terrified of crime. He blamed this fear not on a rational assessment of crime risks, but on exposure to violent television and video games and the aging of the U.S. population in general. The archetype of a sport utility vehicle reflects the reptilian desire for survival, Bradshaw wrote. In other words, Americans... should have said white people like the idea of being able to potentially crush whatever or whoever stood in their way. I usually say if you put a machine gun on top of them, you will sell them better. Rapie is quoted as saying, even going to the supermarket, you have to be ready to fight. This was before the pandemic when they were brawling over corn dogs and toilet paper. Although High and Mighty was published in 2002, in hindsight, much of it looks prophetic. In 2014, for example, BMW unveiled a bulletproof version of its X5 sport utility vehicle, which it described as AK-47 proof. By late 2019, One newspaper reported that the market for bulletproof vehicles is exploding. This was before COVID-19. I would yield, but I did have to pause as I was sitting out on the beach and I said, wait a minute, there is one mighty oversight here. Let me go and pull up my report. I had Daryl Deadman in there for a reason. And then this other report, because I know we talked about this one quite a bit. Let me see. Woo. This was just from all the George Floyd protests that went down. Okay, here we go. Because there were many of these reports. So just tie what you just heard from right of way. Tie that to this report. This is from KFOR, July 2nd, 2021. A group is working to get state question 816 on the ballot. They're hoping to overturn a law giving immunity to drivers who run over protesters if the driver fears for their life. I'm going to stop right there just because there were lots of reports about the Black Lives Matter folks out in the streets. And I got my F-150 and I did. In fact, let me get one more because there were so many of them. The truckers even got involved on this one since we were talking about the SUVs and big vehicles. Like, you want to talk about a big vehicle. Man, one of these 18-wheelers. So they brought up Rodney King, the 90s Rodney King, O.J. Simpson, great times. So they had a report where the truckers were responding to all the protests and people being in the road. This report reads, Mark State, a 20-year-old professional driver out of Melbourne, Florida, wrote a May 31 post on a popular trucker Facebook forum he created called Rookie Room, writing in part, "Dear America, state continued, we will defend ourselves every time, up to and including using our 80,000-pound trucks and its 1,800 foot-pounds of torque to run you over. We don't want to, but we will if we have to save our own life." Cities were looting, rioting, and stopping trucks is happening. You are hereby put on notice, he added. I will stop there and yield. So you were saying about let me give the subtitle again, the dark appeal of the SUV, Ms. Schmidt?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought up about the attacks on protesters, because that has been so scary to watch, and I think it's been underreported. I did a little bit of research about it, and I talked to this guy at the University of Chicago that studies this stuff, and he said during the height of the protests last summer, there was one vehicle ramming incident per day happening. There's incidents where police have been recorded doing this. So it is really a horrifying thing. We are seeing these big vehicles. We're seeing vehicles get bigger and bigger. So on one end of the spectrum, you know, you have maybe you have a mom, and instead of a sedan, she's getting a mid-size SUV. And on the other spectrum, you have these guys that are buying these Ford F-350s, and the front hood on some of these vehicles is five and a half feet. So they may be sitting at a crosswalk in an urban area, and if someone goes by in a wheelchair, for example, or even a shorter person might be totally invisible to them. So you made a lot of good points. I'm sorry. I just want to back up and cover a few things. So you made the point that it's white people purchasing these vehicles. So one thing that's kind of interesting about SUVs is they didn't really exist a few decades ago, except for these very wealthy landowners. This goes back even, I think, to the monarchy in England and Great Britain. So, like, this huge colonial empire. Talk about white supremacy. Like, I think, you know, the British monarchy is a good example. And they used SUVs. These were the only folks back in the day using SUVs. They had these large estates, and they use them for hunting. So they actually have land, and they need that doesn't have roads that they wanted to access by vehicle. So, you know, most Americans, we don't have land where we can drive off-road. There isn't really much of a practical purpose for SUVs. And most Americans that own SUVs never drive off-road. They're just driving in parking lots to the grocery stores like everyone else. But they wanted to sort of ape these very wealthy, very rich, and at the time they would have been almost entirely white people. And so that's sort of the trend does go back to, I think you can tie it to definitely to white people. And the other thing I would say is now people of all, any new car buyer who's buying a new car right now is very likely to buy an SUV. A lot of the auto companies have sort of phased out at this point sedans because they don't make as much profit on them. They make almost $17,000 in profit, these automakers, and they're primarily American automakers, on every Chevy Silverado they sell, for example. So it's been very profitable for them. And the people who are buying new cars are wealthier than the average American. A lot of Americans purchase exclusively used vehicles now. So the automakers are really competing for wealthier and wealthier people at the top of the market. And it is the wealthier people, and I believe that would be primarily white people, who are tilting the market towards these more dangerous vehicles that in turn are disproportionately killing lower income folks.
Context of
white supremacy. Again, all this was before the pandemic. So if there was some sort of unconscious or conscious thought of you might have to brawl and fight at the grocery store over a last bottle of water or Band-Aids or parking space, potato chips, or whatever it might be, like, ooh-wee. I don't see that improving based on what has taken place over the past 18 months. I will check to see if some of our listeners have a question for Angie Schmidt. I was going to ask about my insertion of white, but she beat me to it. It threw me off. I wasn't expecting her to beat me to the punch on that one. Took my question. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Non-Clemson grad read and suggested your book. Reading is more important than watching television. Valedictorian, non-Clemson grad. Did you have a question for Ms. Schmidt?
Yes. Yeah, hey, Gus, and hello to Ms. Angie Schmidt. Thank you for coming on the broadcast today. Can I be here?
Yes, sir.
Ah, perfect. All right. So I came up with a couple of questions. I have, let's see. Let's start with that first question. You use words like inequality, disadvantage, underprivilege. And usually when I've seen a couple of your interviews, when you talk about your book, you usually say, words like privilege and stuff, right? When you say words like privilege or underprivilege, would you agree that it would be more accurate to say, the term white supremacy? And I put this in the context of, when you talk to, you know, other professionals who might be journalists, planners, engineers, do you use the term white supremacy racism to indicate that white people are the cause of the harm, destruction, and death?
You know what? Probably not enough. Probably not enough. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Okay, cool. The reason I bring up that particular question is because, obviously you're a professional, and sometimes it's hard to say certain things when you're at work, right? You don't want to offend someone. And for that reason, I came up with this particular question. When anyone, especially non-white people, refer to circumstances like overrepresentation of non-white people and traffic deaths, incarceration, unemployment, violence in media, do you feel any sense of guilt as if white people like yourself are being indicted for the circumstances that persist and continue? And does guilt prevent you from using more accurate guilt prevent you from using more accurate words or phrases that more accurately describe who is to blame for those types of outcomes like pedestrian deaths?
So do I feel guilt? Yes. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think like, and no white person is totally innocent on this. And sometimes I may be part of the problem without even realizing it. Maybe not on this particular issue, but on other aspects of the problem. So that, I don't know. I mean, that's another good point. I have to think about that. Maybe I should. And the term you would recommend more is white supremacy, is what you're saying, right? To use that term. Instead of,
That is correct. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
And because it's one thing when you say things like privilege or think privilege, bias, underrepresented, overrepresented, or distractionary from what is actually happening, who's to blame and who is being victimized. My next question is, let's see. Give me a moment, please. All right, here we go. Gus brought up that very, very good example about, you know, how people in this country perceive, you know, the purchasing of their cars and what it says to them. And he brought up that really good example of someone saying that, you know, we're going to defend our country. We'll use this $80,000 pound vehicle to run you over. You wrote an article in City Lab called What Happens to Pickup Trucks. You talked about petro-masculinity in reference to increasing sizes of SUVs and pickup trucks. Is increasing vehicle size a representation of covering up any underlying perceptions of white masculinity? Because I believe that was a subtext of your article.
Yeah, I think that I don't fully understand it, but I do think there's something going on. I mean, you can tie these large trucks to Trumpism. We saw them used against Black Lives Matter protesters, which is, I think, domestic terrorism, domestic racial terrorism. So I do think, it's tied in with a lot of things that are going on in our society. I don't fully understand. Definitely it's tied in with masculinity quite a bit, I think. And also, yeah, I do think it's tied to white supremacy and other people. And then in that report, I largely referred to other people who have sort of drawn comparisons. There's a really good cartoon about this. It's about this guy from this guy named Nate Powell. And he ties it into wars overseas and militarism. We see militarism of police vehicles sort of around the same lines. Like I said, I don't fully understand it, but yes, I did write that. And I do think some of these vehicle trends that are having this really negative effect are tied in with loss of sort of superiority or privilege or status, status insecurity on the part of white men.
Can you elaborate on that last part, status insecurity of white men? I think I understand the status part, but security, what are they trying to guard? Because, you know, at least maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but, you know, the increasing size of SUVs and pickup trucks, especially pickup trucks, which have grown exponentially over the last couple of years, like you said, I think is more of a phallic symbol more than anything. And with that increase, with that symbol, you know, how do what exactly might white men be trying to secure with these increasing these vehicles with their increasing size?
Well, the woman I quoted, so we've had this. I don't know how successful a lot of people would consider it, but we've had some gains made by women in the workforce. Some men perceive that as being at a loss to them. We've had sort of a decline in some masculine fields, manufacturing, that type of thing. And especially sometimes it's especially in rural areas. So I think that there's an anger among white men and an, you know, sort of an entitlement, to good jobs, to, sort of a lawlessness that we've seen come out in other areas. And I do think, you know, we have the governor of Florida, for example, Ron DeSantis. He signed a law recently that would indemnify people who strike and injure or hurt or kill protesters if they're blocking traffic. So I do think that we are still catering to white people overall in our policies, and I think in particular white men. And so they've been able to act in sort of a lawless way, in certain respects without, sort of with impunity. And that's one example.
Okay. I got two more questions. I'm gonna try to get through this one. All right. So, this is obviously the college broadcast and interview. Of course, other white professionals like yourself have been invited to interview, you know, journalists, engineers, and planners. Some of the questions that Gus asked you, they did stump you a little bit. When I've seen some of your interviews when you were simply talking about your book, you know, you were very polished in the way you answered your questions about your book, and maybe some things outside of your book, but maybe the Cal stuff kind of got you a little bit. And I juxtapose this to other white people who might have been invited to the Cal in particular. So I say all that to say, you know, what do you think so much about coming on the couch to be interviewed? Because other people who come on, just like yourself, they've come on, chosen not to come on, or maybe even just, you know, cut off halfway because they felt some of the questions were a bit hard because this is a sensitive subject. Some people tend not to want to be truthful. They don't want to deal with it, and they try to send sometimes. Oh, sometimes they lie. Sometimes and then sometimes they run away.
Did you say? I'm sorry. I was just having a little. Did you say come to the couch? You mean come do the interview? Is that what you were saying?
Oh, correct. Correct. Come to this broadcast. You know, white people have been invited to the show. Thank you for your time. But some people, just like yourself, whether it be journalists, engineers, planners, of any profession for that matter, doctors, teachers, etc. Some people have had a hard time answering some of the questions. Like, I believe you got stumped by a couple of questions that the Gus asked you at the very beginning. Some that you simply, might have not answered to the best of your abilities, honestly, or simply might have had a good answer for. And why, you know, how do you feel about coming on the couch answering such sensitive questions, and why other people who say they might want to do something about, you know, like, for example, you're doing something about the racism that's in the engineering or, you know, along the road, but there's other places, you know, obviously where racism exists, like housing, government, health, et cetera, and why other people might have a hard time coming onto the couch versus you coming and doing this, you know, doing your best to answer those questions.
Yeah, I think that they're really, so there's that concept of like white fragility. And again, I'm not an expert on racism. I don't want to try to present myself. Obviously, I grew up in a mostly white area. It was pretty, you know, segregated. And I don't know, I think I'm always trying to unlearn and some of the harmful things that I was taught. But I still think I have a lot of learning to do. So I'm not sure, but I do think that idea about white fragility that's been brought up, I do think that that's true. And I catch myself doing that sometimes too. For some reason.
Okay. We here at the Cows are familiar with the book White Fragility. I think the author's name was Robin DiAngelo. There was an article, because I believe one of the main concepts of her book was like having like get-togethers or forums and workshops to teach white people how not to be racist and stuff. And then there was an article that was published not too soon after to show that when you do those kind of workshops, you know, a lot of the things that book White Fragility was talking about aren't really helpful for convincing white people not to be racist or to engage in racist activity towards non-white people. So I'm a little, maybe a little perplexed, a little caught, not too sure about the idea that white fragility is really to explain why white people might have a hard time, well, doing an interview like the Cows, or just simply not engaging in racist activity. Can you elaborate that on a little bit?
Well, so like I said, it's a little bit hard for me to speak for other people. I do think there's a lot of white people that are very afraid of being called racist. But I think and again, I'm not an expert, but I think like we're all a little bit racist because that's what we were taught. So it's not that there's sort of one class of people that's clearly racist and another group that isn't. We all sort of were brought up in the system of white supremacy, I should say, which thank you for holding me accountable on that. And so we're all sort of unlearning those lessons, or people, at least people who want to. Obviously there's people that are, you know, buying huge pickup trucks and threatening to attack people. So we have people responding the opposite way. But it's a good question. I guess I don't know the answer necessarily.
Okay. I saw one of your last answers. you said that we're all a little bit racist. Do you mean white people, or do you mean everyone, including non-white people as well, too? And then that was also one of the questions that Gus asked you earlier in the interview about, as a white person, when you were growing up, where would you have learned to be racist? And you just said, this is something you learn when you grow up. So while you was growing up, where were you when you were growing up, while you were growing up, that you would have learned this racist concept? Like, what people in your life would you have come across where they would have taught you something that would have made you potentially engage in racist activity? Parents, family, friends, institutions like schools.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So that's a good question. Like, I know there's, so in my family, and I don't want to call out specific people, but I'd say, you know, there's some people that are racist. I know my whole life, I've known people that were sort of overtly racist. So I would say my grandparents on both sides were somewhat racist to this. And it sort of depends on which grandparent to what degree. I shouldn't apply to that at all. But, my parents, weren't as much. I don't want to say, and I do mean white people, but I also think some non-white people can have some anti-black attitudes as well. People, non-white people from other races. But I meant white people are all, you know, are all taught this racist stuff to a degree. From media depictions, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, local news coverage presents ideas that are a little bit racist, stuff I learned in school. I know I went to public school. A lot of the history lessons, you know, come from sort of a white supremacist framework. Like I said, my parents tried to, try to be careful, I think, not to instill me with racist ideas. And I asked my dad one time, like, because I think my dad is really, really pretty not racist, even though he's a white guy and he lives in Ohio and he works in a blue collar field. He works as a contractor. I want to give him too much credit, but he reads like Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he's pretty not racist, in my opinion, compared to a lot of people that he works with and is around. I asked him about it one time because, like I said, I thought his parents really were openly racist. And I think he's just kind of an independent thinker, but I shouldn't go on and on about my dad. But he told me that when he was in high school, he went to a Jesuit high school. And he told me the nuns were really intolerant of any racist talk, that they did not tolerate that. And this would have been an entirely white, this Jesuit high school in the 60s or whatever. But he also said that at the time, a lot of the Jesuit priests and everything were involved with the civil rights movement, and that everyone at his school really admired them for that. And so I don't know, that's what he told me. So anyway, but you know, at my high school, you know, it was I was exposed to racist ideas sort of all the time. And I still am. I mean, it still is such a big part, I think, of our culture, that it's sort of baked into everything. And that's why it's so hard to root out and address, I think.
Okay. I do understand that. So, for example, you said that your grandparents were both racist on both sides, and maybe your parents a little bit. So, you're out to a certain degree. Are you saying that they are racist, or that they engaged in racist behavior? And then, of course, I believe you said you had two young children. Is it possible that, you know, as they get older, that they would say the same thing about you that you said about your parents and grandparents, about you potentially being racist or engaged in racist behavior yourself?
I hope not. You know, I hope not. I hope they wouldn't look back at me that way. But I think, like, on one side of my family, there was, like I said, there's degrees in my grandparents. And I think my parents were, like I said, I think they tried hard not to be. But so I don't want to really single out my parents. But, you know, there are little things like where I grew up, where they, you know, where I grew up, like I said, was a mostly white suburb. My parents moved there because one of their coworkers said that's a place that has good schools, and we were about school age. And now I read about, you know, the kind of assumptions that are baked into that and how that can be, related to, obviously related to racism and, judgments about what kind of school is good and what kind of people it's good for your children to be around. So I'm just kind of ranting. I'm sorry. That's what I would say. I hope not.
Hang on one second. Non-Clemson grad, we had another person who dialed in for a question. We point out words are critical. I point out metaphors on this broadcast frequently. Angie Schmidt has used the metaphor baked into regularly. Gus T does quite a bit of plant-based baking himself, but delectable Negro. Are we baking? Or are we talking about a system of terrorism? Our caller in Georgia, did you have a question for Angie Schmidt? You should be with us. Sorry about that, folks. Got disconnected for a moment. Right as I was going to get our caller in Georgia, we will get her back on the line right now. Couldn't be. I told you it has been grueling every step of the way. Of course, we couldn't get through without getting disconnected and all that looniness. All right. So we should have. There we go. Got Ms. Schmidt back. Thank you for your patience. We should be reconnected as well. Let's see. Our caller in Georgia. Did we get you back with us? Caller in Georgia.
Hello.
Yes. Thank you for your patience, ma'am. It was us who got disconnected, but
okay,
we are back now.
Okay, that's not a problem. I call back, so you never know what you think.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, we're not, people that look like us are not in control, but that's another issue. Thanks for taking my call, and hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can have. I have some questions about if you knew anything about the drivers in the survey. Do you know if they had passengers, specifically children, in the car when they had these incidents of hitting people? You know?
In my book, you mean?
I didn't read the book. So.
I don't know. That's a good question. None of the cases I highlighted, I don't think they had children in the car when they struck people. No. But I did write about some people that struck children.
And then I guess the second question, was there any, surveys or any reports about how white pedestrians interact? I can just say anecdotally, if I'm driving and a white person is walking, they see me, they keep walking like, I know this nigga better not, well, I think that's what they think, I don't know, better not hit me. Was there anything like that in your research? Them walking, like, I know I can't be hit because I'm white.
A little more confidently? No, but that's a good point. It would be a little bit rational for them to expect cars to yield to them more, especially groups like white women, because in that research that was cited earlier, they said they're better about yielding to women. So yeah, that would make sense. But no, I haven't looked at that. I'm sorry.
And then have you you talked to several groups, I'm guessing some white, some black, some different ethnicities, you know, a cross-section of people, if you will. What are the reactions? Because I was kind of looking at some of the reviews online, and considering the book is about race and class, none of the reviews, even though they all gave great reviews, I don't know if hopefully they're just objective people and not your buddies, you know, they gave great reviews, but none of them brought up race when race is explicitly in the title. And that's all I have.
In the review?
Well, I saw that interview, so I'm wondering, when you talk to people about your book, you know, I know in this context, we definitely brought up race. Like one of the views brought up something about older people, which, you know, I don't want older people to get hit. You know, that's bad. But race is in the title. But do you notice that white people gloss over that and they may talk about other things? And I don't, you know, I'm trying not to answer the question for you, but.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. Yeah, that might be true. I do think the problem does affect a lot of disadvantaged people. So like people with disabilities seem to be at increased risk too. Low income people. But there was some reporting recently because there was new data that came out showing that in 2020, there was a big increase and Black people were affected particularly. They said there was a 23% increase in pedestrian fatalities involving Black people just in the last year, just in 2020. So there was some attention to that. And Charles Brown, who wrote the foreword for my book, did some interviews about that as well. So I think people are especially because of all the focus that's been on racial justice in the last year. I think people are becoming more sensitive to it, but you might be right that, you know, white people still do gloss over it too much.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
For sure. I was going to get our other caller, but just to her point, or I guess let's see if I can do them in order. So earlier we were talking about Mr. Salazar, his first name, Arnulfo. Hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. A-R-N-U-L-F-O, Arnulfo Salazar. And then our caller in Georgia, she was asking about incidents where these collisions happen, sometimes criminal. Do they have passengers? One of the reports that we had the audio segment at the beginning, we just played a snippet of it. That one there was, I'll just read a little bit, a Piedmont wealth manager who allegedly left his wife and a dying man at the scene of a hit and run faces manslaughter charge. This was on Mother's Day of this year. The impact of the crash on the afternoon of Mother's Day through Gregory Turnage Jr. In fact, based on the statistics of our book, Ms. Schmidt, do you want to take a guess at the racial classification of the victim in this incident based on your research and information? Gregory Turnage Jr., the victim, 41 years old.
Was he a Black man?
Black male privilege again. Yes, Black male. through Gregory Turnage Jr., now that is one to laugh at for sure. Gregory Turnage Jr. was thrown onto the hood of a white Lexus before he fell to the Oakland sidewalk. As he lay bleeding, witnesses said the driver opened his door and walked around the smashed front bumper before looking down at Turnage's crumpled body. But rather than call 911 or render aid to the Oakland father, we don't have Black male fathers, the driver fled on foot, according to the witnesses and Oakland police investigators, leaving behind a gravely injured Turnage as well as his own wife, who remained in the front passenger seat of the Lexus behind a deployed airbag. And it goes on to give more information. Of course, once again, the suspect in this case, Mr. Timothy Amano, allegedly had consumed several drinks before they hit Mr. Turnage. Again, what does he say? Sobriety would be best. The person who dialed in, not finding it. You have to be patient with me. Oh, there it is. 1159. 1159. Did you have a question for Ms. Schmidt?
Greetings, guys, and greetings, callers, and greetings, Ms. Schmidt. Yes, I have two questions, if I may. The first one being, Ms. Schmidt, am I correct in understanding that the greatest thing that white men and white women have in common is the practice of racism, white supremacy, and maintaining it. That's the question.
The greatest thing they have in common? I mean, yes, they both do. They both absolutely do that. I don't want to excuse white women from that, if that's what you're saying.
Okay, and the second question is, thanks for answering. The second question is, would it be possible for you to share a racist joke you may have heard from a racist friend or associate or a family member?
A racist joke? I can't think of a racist joke. I can think of racist remarks that I've heard that come to mind. I honestly cannot think of someone telling me a racist joke that I remember. Would that be a remark? I'm sure people have told me racist jokes in the past, in the distant past, but.
I suppose the remarks can be some sort of compensation for your inability to remember a joke.
Okay. When I was growing up, people used to, when I was growing up in high school, people used to, one thing I remember is people would, if we drove through a black neighborhood, like think they were going to get shot. They'd be like, duck down, we're going to get shot. There's going to be a drive-by. That's one thing I remember real clearly that I look back and think was racist.
Were those friends or family members in the car with you?
Friends. It would have been friends, like when I was in high school.
Mm.
Just girlfriend to high school.
Thank you.
Did that? Those were your questions, sir? You didn't have anything else?
That was all.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly. Other folks, don't wait till the last minute. If you have a question, we have our 10 minutes. I want to make sure I get my Seattle question in. But before I do, I just want, number one, Ta-Nehisi Coates was mentioned. I think our guest, Angie Schmidt, she said that her father, who she said was different from other folks in his field and what have you, he reads Ta-Nehisi Coates. We've read a little time. He's written quite a bit. So, I mean, hey, I just thought it was interesting because Ta-Nehisi Coates is the source of the quote from earlier about white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. And I said, no, that is not true. So I don't know. Maybe he didn't read that one. But it was your dad. Is that correct? Who reads the Ta-Nehisi Coates? Is that accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe he didn't. Hopefully he didn't read that report because that is not a good one. Spreading false information. Incidentally, when she mentioned the Jesuit schools, and maybe that had an influence because they didn't tolerate any racism and, you know, we're going to treat people correctly, I guess, which is a good thing if that was the case. Just remember, we had the report from this past weekend where we were talking about the Catholic schools and them reckoning with their involvement in slavery and the practice of racism, white supremacy. So it being a Jesuit school, at least to me, would not necessarily signify that, hey, no racism, white supremacy is practiced here on this here planet. The religion of white supremacy dominates. I just also wanted to make sure. Now, man, we talked about words are important. The minimize, they call them accidents. All the rest of it. And blaming the, they say the car hit, you know, little Sammy or Mr. Salazar, all the rest of the car, as opposed to the pedestrian. And I said they do the exact, white people do the exact same thing with white supremacy racism. In my view, that's the reason that this title is white of right of way race class and then blah blah blah, not racism or white supremacy class. which would be totally accurate, much more to the point of what we're talking about. But Angie Schmidt did the exact same thing in responding to non-Clemson grad when he went back. We said, put a pin in it. Let's go back to that question. So how did you come to find out that you are a white person? Now, she said, she was talking about her grandparents. She said they were somewhat racist. Now, I say racism is a crime like anything else. So if I sat and I said, now, old Bill here is somewhat of a rapist. Bill's parents are a little bit less of rapists, but Bill is somewhat of a rapist. They don't minimize in that manner with any other crime. It would just be Bill's a rapist and we move forward. Bill's a child rapist. We move forward. Bill's a racist. Not a little bit. And it's always that. Even when somebody's called a nigger, it doesn't matter what it is. It's, most of the time, it doesn't even get it. Most of the time, I don't think Bill's a racist. You know, he's a pretty good fella, and he might have had a bad day and said something wrong. But I don't think Bill's a racist. The minimizing is extraordinary in the system of white supremacy. But to Seattle. Now, I brag about Seattle all the time. I've been here over a decade. The Cows has existed for almost 13 years. I've been in Seattle the entire time. Wow. Amazing city, and I learn even the longer that I'm here, like, wow, what an amazing place that does not have very many black people. I attach that all the time. Amazing, not very many black people. Now, I do give it warts and all. I don't try and, you know, sell people on some fiction. So we'll get to the loveliness, but I mean, I generally don't even say city. Same thing I said before. Seattle is an amazing plantation. Why do we say that, Gus T? Amy Schmidt, in her book, she says the situation, talking about a pattern of unequal enforcement, the subsection, she writes, the situation is remarkably similar in Seattle. Black residents received 26% of the city's jaywalking tickets in 2016, according to a Seattle Times investigation, despite making up just 7% of the city's population. That doesn't surprise me at all, because we had a Seattle City prosecuting attorney on the program about 8 years ago. She said 40% of the cases she prosecutes are black people, and I believe it was mostly black males. Black male privilege again, where only 7% of the city, but almost half of your prosecuting caseload. Black male privilege. The bias. The bias persisted even as Seattle's police department was under scrutiny for racist enforcement. There we go. In 2010, a Seattle police officer was captured punching a teenage girl who had been stopped for jaywalking, and the video went viral. As a result, Seattle police dramatically reduced the number of jaywalking tickets they were issuing. But 6 years later, the racial disparity had actually gotten worse. In 2017, vexed by the intractableness of the problem, one Seattle City Council member, Lorna Gonzalez, said that she would explore potentially eliminating the city's jaywalking statute altogether, but the issue was never brought before the full council for vote. I will stop there because it is still a plantation. And in fact, even Gus T, I have been chided by enforcement officials downtown, close to Pike or close to Pine and Forth, about jaywalking because I was not in the crosswalk. I was about 5 feet over. Hey, get back in the crosswalk. Sorry. So that is real. They do fuss at black people about jaywalking, especially in the city center. But that notwithstanding, you write in your book, this is one of the safest places for pedestrians, cyclists. They do not have very many black people. What makes Seattle so special and safe in comparison to other U.S. cities?
Well, I do think that they put more effort into it. They put there's a really good, you have a really good, since you love Seattle, you have a really good traffic engineer who's in charge there. Dong Ho Chang is his name, and everyone in the field really likes him. I mentioned him in the book. There's one thing that's an injustice, I think, is that there's this obscure rule book called the MUTCD, and it sort of says It tells engineers not to put in crosswalks. So while we're penalizing and arresting people, and sometimes people get assaulted by police for jaywalking, secretly we're telling engineers not to put crosswalks in places. So in Seattle, he has sort of challenged that, and they figured out a new way to approach it that puts in the, it's sort of complex, but defaults with putting in more crosswalks, for example.
Seattle has an extraordinary number of crosswalks. It is, I can use the term I learned from your book. It is a very gritty city. And I was, as I read your book, you were saying that cities that were designed that had trolley cars, they tend to be a little bit more gritty, safer for pedestrians. Seattle had trolley cars in the 1940s, 1950s, lots of right angle turns. They just have crosswalks and bike lanes galore. Even as you spread out from the inner city, it's still tons and tons of crosswalks, bike lanes, neon colored bike lanes, neon colored crosswalks, wide sidewalks, like at least in most of the main parts of Seattle proper, it is pretty difficult to, well, I won't say that, there's a lot of traffic, but pedestrian safety is pretty good. They have high walk scores. You can walk safely around. I'll ask it this way. Do you think that a part of why Seattle has such amazing safety standards and the city planning, do you think a part of that is because they have such a low population of Black people?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a big problem. So Black, there's racism in the public sector, in the way resources like street safety resources are dispersed, very much so, yes. Like an example I use in my book is Portland. And in Portland, the more diverse and lower income part of town is called East Portland. And that it, and people who live in East Portland, for example, have twice the chance of being killed in traffic. And Portland looked at their 30 most dangerous intersections, and 28 out of 30 are in East Portland. So that also shows that their infrastructure is more dangerous. We have the same pattern also in Cleveland. Our most dangerous streets are almost exclusively neighborhoods of color.
In my view, if 28 out of the 30 most dangerous areas in Portland, which is also another area which has very few Black people and is deliberate, that was the word I was going to use anyway, but deliberately has very few Black people, according to the Oregon State Constitution, which was never changed, which disallowed Black people from living in the state of Oregon, which is why they don't have that very many Black people there to this day. But if 28 out of the 30 most dangerous streets, cross sections, are where the few Black people that are here reside, that is deliberate and willful, period. That's what I mean about the minimizing and, oh, this is accidental and unlearning and fragility. It's fragile living in an area with no crosswalks, no public transportation. That is fragile. Doing that deliberately in town after town and city after city, that is the intractableness, the dedication of individuals classified as white. We did our full time. I just want to check in. Non-Clemson grad, did you have a final brief question that you wanted to get in before we allow Ms. Schmidt to depart for the evening?
No, that is all. I think I got through all my questions. I can't find it right now. My computer had a bit of an issue after I finished my last question. But no, Ms. Schmidt, I thank you very much for your time and coming on to the Gals.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.
It has been a hoot. The book that we've been talking about again, Right of Way. Let me see if we can give the full title before we go, in case folks want to check it out to read. Race, again, it should be racism or white supremacy, but Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Angie Schmidt. Man, it's been a long week. Thank you so much for hanging out for your Monday evening, being patient with us, getting a few questions learned. I learned quite a bit from the book. Fascinating read while I sat out on the lovely Seattle beaches. Thanks so much and enjoy your Monday evening, Ms. Schmidt.
Yep, see you guys too.
Take care. Context of white supremacy. White guests only. Can't say it enough. Man, oh man. White guests only. All of us can work on asking white people questions and get some of the information. They are the folks to learn from. I can't emphasize enough. I meant to do this in the section. I was more focused on making sure I got in the folks who dialed in with questions. But man, when we talk to white guests, these folks, she's not affiliated with the university, but if they're affiliated with the university institution of some nature, and or they have their own institution, private network, charity, whatever it is, NGO, nonprofit, whatever. It is amazing. These folks, and let me get her credentials. So, and in addition to writing the book that we just talked about, published last year, she has had reports published in the New York Times, The Atlantic, National Public Radio, and is the founder and principal of 3MPH Planning and Consulting. You generally don't open a consulting firm if you are a dunce. Now, I know she said, hey, I'm an expert about urban planning, pedestrian safety. I get it. But racism, white supremacy, not only is a core component of that, as she testified to, but that's in the title of the book, Race, Class. We just said it. Give the whole thing. And the silent epidemic of pedestrian deaths in America, which is disproportionately non-white male. She talked about it in the book. We talked about it on the program. Like, the number of times when you have a white person, when you start asking them logical questions, paying attention to the words that they use, making sure that your question gets answered, and then all of a sudden the very same people who any other time they brag and boast about how smart they are and how much more intelligent they are than you, your entire family, everyone that you've ever known, that you all are the most ignorant, retarded, toothless coons in the universe, and I'm the smartest person ever. Didn't you see all my degrees? I got a perfect score on the ACT, the SAT, graduate school. Like, what? Back up off. I got a 4.5 GPA. Back up. Like, that's the way they normally talk to us. And now it's, oh no, I'm an idiot, you see. I don't know nothing about nothing. I can't even spell racism. How you say racism? Spell it for me. That big, them big words you use, white support, boy, what? White support? I can't even say that. What did I tell you? The white person just this month, she said, what is it? I didn't want them to say that I had the, what is it? Implicit bias. I think that's how you... All of a sudden, the very people who have all this expertise now don't know nothing. Can't remember nothing. Racist jokes. Ooh. Ooh. What does it mean to be white? Ooh. How did I learn that? Ooh. Hmm. Now it takes you an hour to think about all that. All of that from master deceivers I look at with extraordinary suspicion. In my view, that's just... you're practicing white supremacy racism. I guess generally that could be effective for non-white people who are confused about racism and they think the concepts we've been given, that white people are just confused about all this, they don't know, they just need to read some Ta-Nehisi Coates and they'll change their behavior. All of that is a dangerous lie. Dedication. When a white person tells you 28 out of 30 of the most dangerous streets in this city is where the niggers live, that's not an accident. That's not what we need to learn. That is exactly how this is supposed to function. Run the net. What did Daryl Deadman say? I ran that nigger over. Very short break. We'll check in, see if folks have any thoughts before we wrap up. White guests only. Context of white supremacy.
And from the late 1960s, after the death of Martin Luther King and the riots and the upheavals and all like this, and black people with their fists in the air and all like that, and trying to stumble and fumble and find their way and get focus, the white supremacists made a blueprint and put it in action. And that is, I'm going to have these people so confused, they don't even know what they started out to do. And by the late 1970s, they had just about completed it. And we've been on that ever since. And you mentioned something very important. They are more comfortable than ever. But see, it's like making gorillas comfortable in a cage, or monkeys, or pandas. You still got them in a cage, but they're comfortable. See, so give him some bling bling. It's like giving an animal a brand new car and training the animal to ride up and down the street in it. And then you stand back and point at the animal. Like one white man said in the late 1950s, he said he doesn't care what kind of car a Negro has. He said he's still a nigger. And when he rides by in a shiny car, to him, it's just a monkey in a car. White people built the car, put a monkey in it, trained the monkey to drive the car. So now you're looking at a monkey in a car. See, but black people don't see themselves that way. But this is how the white supremacists see us, and they are the ones who run our business. And we have to know that, that when they look at us, that's what they see. That's what they see. And at a subliminal level, what they see begins to spill over into our brains so that we, at a subliminal level, see each other that way. And indirectly see ourselves that way.
Context of white supremacy. Woo. Nearly full of Junior. So, we will be here at minimum on Thursday for the book club. Oh, we're finishing. I can't believe it. We'll be all done with Labyrinth, Randall Sullivan, The Assassinations of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., Death Row Records, all of that. Thursday, wrapping up, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward. Check out City of Lies if you've not seen it by now, for this coming Thursday, and we'll share our closing thoughts. Wow. I'll say number one, man, oh man, this will be one program I will remember. Like, this has been such a stressful, grueling, traumatizing, unpleasant year. Man, like, no cap, as the young folks say. I am not sure I will make it to 2022. I guess you could say that any year, but I mean, woof, I have had more doubt this year than at any other time. We shall see. All of the gruelingness and what have you, like, man, it could have been really easy to be like, you know what? Forget this program. We'll do something else. We'll call up Ms. Schmidt, see if she can reschedule. Maybe we can do it next Monday or later this week or something. But stay the course. Counter-racist grind is not exactly easy. All of that said, or I guess even you can put it in context, Gus T, I have visited more beaches and more, what would I say, popular attractions in the greater Seattle area over the past like 3 months than I have almost at any time in my tenure here in Seattle. Like, I've gone to some of the best beaches that they have here in Seattle and hung out. Even went to some of the beaches that are outside of Seattle and hung out. Got some amazing pictures. And in fact, was still on the counter-racist grind. Went to the beach to read this book. Exactly as you heard me say to Ms. Schmidt, I was reading Right of Way at the beach yesterday. Beautiful. It was one of the few black people out there for most of the day. I would read a little bit, take a break, take some pictures, look at the water, relax, and go back to reading. And it was amazing just being in Seattle, in a city where she talks about where they have an abundance of crosswalks, an abundance of sidewalks, an abundance of bike lanes. The public transportation, that was one thing I was going to compare Atlanta to Seattle. In Atlanta, they have MARTA. In Seattle, they have the light rail in addition to all the other, they have the ferry in Seattle. They have lots to public transportation, but they have the light rail. So with the light rail, they are expanding it. It's to the point now where it really, if you're close to the light rail, it really doesn't matter if you live in downtown Seattle. You really don't even have to live in Seattle because they're about to also have the bullet train that will go from Tacoma to Seattle, I think, in like 30 minutes. I don't think you can drive that. I mean, it would have to be like no traffic. You'd have to speed. Like we were talking about, you'd have to be pedal to the metal, speeding, perfect conditions to do that with a car. Like for that to be reliable any time of day, 30 minutes, I would think it is, Tacoma to Seattle. Like their public transportation is so good. You could live way outside of Seattle, way outside of the center of the city, and still not have a car and get to anything you need easily, efficiently. It is astounding. And it's well connected. I was contrasting that with Atlanta, huge population of black people. Their public transportation sucks, and it sucks deliberately. That word again, willfully. The white people who designed it said, we do not want these Negroes to be able to efficiently move throughout the metropolitan Atlanta area, the capital city of Georgia. And so MARTA doesn't work as well as the light rail does here. MARTA, you can't get on the MARTA and go like from the airport up to Lenox Mall unless they've greatly expanded it since I left. And I know white people have not done that. You can check me and let me know I'm talking crazy and I'll hush, but I am real sure they've been talking about seceding from the city of Atlanta in the northern part of the city. But there's a reason you can't hop on the train, the MARTA, and just go all the way to Lenox Mall. They don't want the Negroes to go that far south. They don't want it to work efficiently. Whereas here, they've expanded the light rail. You can go all the way up to freaking Linwood almost, and as far south as like Federal Way. It's amazing. Like, this not being my field, again, non-Clemson grad recommended this book. This is his area of expertise. Valedictorian, I'm so glad he recommended the book. But now I have even more data as to what makes Seattle so special. Like, walker-friendly, they have that. Like, they are so into having walker-friendly living quarters. Where you don't, as she talked about the younger culture, where you don't have to have a car. You can do the ride share, you can bike, you can use public transportation, you can walk and easily access all the wonderful things in your neighborhood and area. They're so into that. And you can, it's easy because the city is designed easy access for, easy, safe access for pedestrians. I'm gonna have to take like pictures of some of the many like just crosswalks and the bike lanes and all that. Like when I first got here, it stood out to me because I hadn't seen as much of that in other places, and it's only expanded exponentially since when I first got here. Like, it is extraordinary. And then they don't have very many Negroes. Anything folks would like to share about what they heard from Ms. Schmidt, her commentary on the broadcast? Our caller in Georgia. Yes, ma'am. That you can let us know. Have they expanded the MARTA so that you could take it all the way up to Lenox Mall?
Well, when I was in college, I could do that. That was in the 90s. I don't know when you lived in Atlanta, but I could do that in the 90s.
Oh, well, I lived there in the 2000. Red line. I lived there in 2000, and you could not take the MARTA up to Lenox Mall. You'd have to get off at like... I have to go back and look at the map to see where you'd get off. Midtown, I remember that would be the stop where I would get off at, is Midtown. And then they didn't even connect. When I say, like, you could get stuck, like, depending on what time of day it is, like, it's like you could take the MARTA and get off at Little Five Points or wherever, Midtown, wherever you are, and you might have a connect there, might not. Like, pfft.
Yeah, I mean, I don't live in Atlanta, but, I mean, it is poorly... And again, I come from New York City, so almost anything is poorly designed to me. But yeah, it is pretty poorly designed, but I guess maybe because I was in college, you know, I don't know if there was a break in the 2000s, but no, I was in college. I took the I got on at the West End and, you know, got up at Lenox Mall and walked right there. Yeah, maybe there was something in the middle of the 2000s. I know the buses are awful. They definitely don't want to expand the buses because the train is so, what we call it, the train, you know, the rail is very limited. It's just like a cross up and down. And if you don't live by it, you know, God bless you. But I guess one question I forgot to ask, since you were talking about the rail and stuff, I know she said she lived in Ohio. I had lived in Ohio for a while, too, and there was a time, I guess, they were expanding funds. And they were talking about increasing rail lines and everything, and there was a proposal to run a rail line from Cleveland down through Dayton and Cincinnati, like a light rail, so like people can work in those areas. And white people pretty much shut it down. And I believe the funds were to California. I guess I should have asked about that since you talked about traffic. I know that came up, but I didn't think about that until you started talking about the rail. And yes, in a lot of, because like I said, I don't live in Atlanta, but this place that I live, you know, they only have the bus and it's, it's just hard. You should see I'm pretty much speechless about it, but I know here if you don't have a car, it's a wrap. And then I forgot this was coming up, but I was watching some YouTube clips about urban planning and things like that and how it was kind of done on purpose and, you know, like some of the racism things and, you know, the white people wanted to move out to the suburbs and now they're moving back and, you know, things like that. So it was pretty interesting. I think this was very constructive. I don't know if I necessarily learned so much, but, you know, it did get me interested in things like that because, I do notice. And again, coming from New York, where, you know, plentiful transportation, if you can't get the train, there are a lot of buses. And I guess, you know, some of that would spill over into gentrification, because I know in the areas outside of New York City, those areas that are near, of course, the train, what we call the subway, the train, those areas definitely are becoming more gentrified, more so. Maybe than a Brownsville, which has some train access. I'm not going to say it doesn't, but definitely more bus and more spread out where I believe it's slower in that area, per se. Thank you.
Slower in that area. She said slower means safer. Oh, I forgot to... That's why I said it's such an important topic.
Well, I don't mean slower and safer. I meant slower in the terms of the white people moving to the area.
Oh, okay. I got you. Slower in terms of what they call gentrification. I got you. Just that term slow, I guess it had my brain computer like, oh, man, I forgot to bring that up. Where the white people are here, I don't know if they have them. I'm sure they do, but I just hadn't seen them in such great abundance. They have those signs. Well, they're not signs. They're like neon silhouettes of, it looks like a little turtle running or a little child running to slow people down so they can be all safe in the neighborhood. Like, amazing. But yes, in the inefficiency of the public transportation in Atlanta, like that's one of those areas where I'd say you definitely need a car to get around. And she talks about that in the book, how for a lot of places, they were not designed for pedestrians. They were designed really for white people with cars to be able to motor around and do whatever they need to do. And if you do not have a vehicle, then not only are you not going to be able to access things, but you might not even be safe in just being able to get out and walk. I had to go back and look at the map. I say strive for accuracy. The MARTA does go to Lenox Mall. It's just been a minute since I've caught it, and it's been a very stressful day, so my brain computer not working at best capacity. The MARTA does go to Lenox Mall. That does not in any way counter or offset the inefficiency of metropolitan public transportation in Atlanta. And in fact, MARTA I'd have to go and look at it again to get the exact what that acronym is, but I know for like decades it was mockingly called by racists moving Africans rapidly through Atlanta, mockingly called that. And I think even in some parlance, moving apes rapidly, but you know, same thing really. Yeah, so I mean, that in my view tells you all you need to know. And in fact, I think in 2013 they had a snowstorm in Atlanta, one of the times where it would have been amazing to have awesome sparkly public transportation like we do here in Seattle. So hey, let me park this vehicle, that word again, safety, park that vehicle, hop on the MARTA and get home. And couldn't do that because we don't want the Negroes to move around efficiently. So people were slipping and sliding all over 285 and the rest of it, like consequences to racism sometimes. Let's see. Other folks with commentary that they wanted to make sure they share.
Can I be heard?
Our caller in California. Yes, sir.
This broadcast was very constructive. I live in an area that doesn't have a lot of sidewalks. And I go on these long walks, and walking in the street, having to pay attention to the cars coming from behind me, and not understanding that this is a act of racism, that this has been planned. Because there's also a lot of homeless people around where I live. So I'm like, this is a really sophisticated death trap that they've manufactured. And I wasn't even aware of it until this broadcast. And also, a lot of pickup trucks are in this area, in modified pickup trucks with, like, bigger wheels and, like, these giant bumpers on the front that white people are driving around. So very, very, very white people around over here are very prepared and on their task. Very constructive broadcast. Learned a lot.
Much obliged. Glad it was worthy of your time and energy this Monday evening. I learned a lot reading the book and then the program as well. I generally learn a lot when we can have white guests on the program, but just some of the things like that. That's when we talk about a total system of white supremacy racism, like everything is designed to support that overall objective, white domination of non-white people, especially individuals classified as black. Everything means everything. And I mean, it's difficult, I think, for victims of white supremacy to grasp that, what that means, like in a functional sense. That means there's a reason you don't have sidewalks. That means there's a reason. He talked about the size, and that's in her book too, the size of the trucks, even what types of vehicles are allowed to be on your street, even the zoning about how much traffic, what businesses, because that also dictates what, you know, vehicles are going to be on that street, what businesses can be here and what businesses can't be here. What type of houses can be? We talked about that, too. All of that impacts how much traffic are we going to have here. She talked about the code book that determines the crosswalks. And, you know, under what circumstances do you need a crosswalk? I think they said it's supposed to be like 93 crosses per hour, an average of, in terms of the number of pedestrians that use that intersection before it necessitates a crosswalk. Like, who came up with this number? Someone classified as white. Totally arbitrary. So if it's 85 people an hour, we don't need a crosswalk. If it's a school close by, we don't need a crosswalk. It's just paint, right? She emphasized that in the book too. Like, it's just paint. It's not like we're talking about, you know, we're going to need satellite technology and computer. It's just paint, right? There might be a local distributor give us a really cheap bargain on some paint, right? Not that big a deal. Easy to put crosswalks down. Yeah. Particularly, like I said, for me, this was fascinating because Seattle is mentioned so regularly in the book as an example of the correct way to design cities for the safety of white pedestrians. I can say it like that because they don't have very many Gus T. Renegades here. And even what he said about, hey, I like to walk this street to meditate, get some exercise. Everyone should do that. Get those 10,000 steps a day, they say. 7,000 is probably enough. But no sidewalks. I got to constantly be looking for cars. You don't have to do that in Seattle, even in the outskirts for the most part. And even like the exact street that I live on currently, there's no sidewalk. There doesn't need to be. What did I just say? They have about 50 billion of those green neon signs. Slow down. Children play here. Slow down. 20 is enough. That billions of those all over the street. The speed limit is 20, and they don't have tons of it is a residential area, so it's not big pickup trucks with their big grills and all the rest of it. Very slow cruising. People yield to the children, joggers, white people. Very easy. In fact, I can contrast this to when I lived much further south, much less ritzier neighborhood, four-lane highway with no crosswalk. Exactly what she talked about in the book. Trucks are zooming, and the speed limit, I think, was 35, but people used to go like 40 and all the rest of it through there all the time. No enforcement of the speed limit and no crosswalk. Four lane. That's exactly what she talked about in the book, and it's no accident. You go to areas where the concentration of non-white people starts to go up, and those type of things disappear. Sidewalks, speed humps, enforcement of speed limit, all of that. Bike lanes, all of that disappears. Traffic, and again, like I said, these are it's not like, you know, oh, we can't invest in all that because we don't have the money. Very cheap fixes. Again, that's dedication. And Daryl Dedman ran that nigger over. I can't emphasize Monster's Ball. I hope people didn't miss that. In my view, that is so critically important. That film is celebrated. That's in the middle of the film. Run over, and it's not a black male, it's not a black man, it's a black child. Fat black boy, bang, run him over, and as exactly the language I use, that's the aphrodisiac for Billy Bob Thornton, sexually sewering Halle Berry, Academy Award. I don't think that inspired a whole lot of people to think differently about pedestrian safety, hit and runs. Maybe I'm wrong. Any other folks, comments they want to get in, what they heard from Amy Schmidt, our broadcast today? Everybody satisfied?
Got it all.
Did I hear? Let's see. Now oh, non-Clemson grad? Non-Clemson grad? Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. I'm very happy that I was able to catch this broadcast. I think the last person I invited, unfortunately, I missed because I got confused about the hours that the show was going. But it was nice to be able to definitely ask her the questions that I asked her. But she heard a lot of the stuff she talked about in her book are absolutely right. Right now, I feel like I have a lot of disagreements with engineers, you know, what I do in the area where I live. And she's absolutely right, trying to get these people to actually do stuff and not commit the kind of atrocities that they commit is a very hard thing to do. Apparently, my wife has some questions as well, too, real quick.
Hello, Cal's listeners. Hi, Gus. This is Misty reporting a couple things about being a pedestrian myself. Here in South Carolina, where we live, it is very, very, very dangerous to be a pedestrian. I don't think if we or when we have children, I would allow them outside by themselves because where we are, there's very, very, very few sidewalks. And so you basically have to walk in the ditch. And sometimes there's a lot of weeds growing and, you know, there's some ivy growing, like poison ivy, or it's just muddy. And cars do not slow down. So even if the speed limit signs are posted or most recently our neighborhood in different areas around town, they decided to print these signs that said, slow down, you know, neighborhood, you know, slow down in this neighborhood, that kind of thing. But nothing has changed. So I've dedicated myself to trying to walk you know, at least like 1,000 steps in the neighborhood. Sometimes I get like 6,000 steps all the way up to 12,000, but I just want to walk around the neighborhood, like 1,000 steps. And it gives me a chance to meet my neighbors, see what's going on in the neighborhood, like new developments and everything. But as I was saying, where we are, there's very, very, very few sidewalks, if any at all. And you're always constantly having to look left, right, looking back multiple times before crossing streets. And in areas where there are sidewalks and bike lanes, people will be speeding. It may be like 30, 35 miles per hour. But the other day, I almost got hit because somebody crossed the white line into the bike lane and onto the sidewalk. So, you know, it's almost like every time you go outside, you know, you're risking it. And most recently, I think we had 2 hit and run deaths in this area back in June. There were 2 white women who were involved in a hit and run accident after they found out who the drivers were and everything and arrested them. Both of the drivers, they stole vehicles, and they hit these women. So one of the women, she was running with her dog, and she was on the sidewalk, and then the driver crossed over multiple lanes and then hit her on the sidewalk and pinned her up against a tree and then, you know, drove away. Other people saw it. They were able to apprehend the driver. And, you know, people in this area, they did a GoFundMe, raised like $70,000 for her children. And then the other woman, she was cycling with her husband and she was crossing at these intersections. There's like a trail that goes from the south part of the city all the way up to the north part of the city and beyond. And she was crossing this intersection, which my husband and I, non-Clemson grad, we always cross these intersections, and I always think they're so, so, so dangerous. And again, if I was a child, you know, you just think it's safe, you know, people are going to watch out for you. It's not the case. But this woman, she was cycling with her husband. Her husband must have got across, and then she got hit. And that driver, of course, did a hit and run. And it's pretty common in this area. There's so much growth. There's so much development. You know, we're only going to see an influx in the number of pedestrians who die, whether they're on bike, whether they're on foot. In the first case where the woman was walking with her dog, a lot of people in this area on that app, I think it's called Nextdoor, you know, people named the victim of, you know, the hit and run, but then they also named the dog. So they were very concerned about the dog who passed away. And you know, it's just baffling, you know, you're trying to do something, that's good for your health and your wellness, like getting outside or going for a walk or going for a bike ride or being outdoors with your children. But if you're not in a car, it's a safety issue. It's a safety issue. So when people say, where's a safe area? I always attributed it to where are the white people? Let me move away from where the non-white people are. But now I realize that when they say safe, you know, where are neighborhoods where, you know, I can go outside, that I can actually like make it back home safely after I go for a walk or a run or I go cycling or whatever. So with that, I'll end my report.
Safety, that word again, safety. And again, just a different context, because I wouldn't have thought of that before in terms of safety. When I think of a safe neighborhood, like crime, and, you know, are they going to be burglars, and are they going to break in our mailbox, or, you know, that those are the type of things that I'd be thinking about. Drugs, that type of thing, property theft, not sidewalks. Bike lane. Speed limits. I wouldn't have really thought about that. Like, oh yeah, that's especially if you're talking about children, like, ooh, wee, yes, speed limits. the size of the vehicle. She talks about that in the book, too. I think the previous caller in California talked about that also, having big, huge vehicles. I mean, Lord, it's a big difference if you have a Tesla four-door, if that drifts over onto the sidewalk or what have you, as opposed to if it's an F-150 or, you know, some kind of Cadillac Escalade. Very big difference. And then if you're speeding and all the rest of it, she talks about that. And this, I think that goes in with non-Clemson grad. Glad he brought that report in about the toxic masculinity tied with getting these big supersized SUV vehicles for white men, even though I think I see a number of white women drivers of those vehicles too, or at least passengers in them. Anywho, but yeah, those big vehicles, I mean, hey, that's, I got my big car and I will run you niggers over. You should be afraid of me. I'll run you all down. I just wouldn't have thought of that as a safety. Yeah, even that, like how many SUVs are in this neighborhood? Like even thinking of that as a safety concern, like, lots to process. Yes, Missy? Yes, ma'am?
They are everywhere. They are everywhere. Like, you know, we're in the South and it's a big deal for people who don't do any type of work, like moving furniture or, you know, hauling dirt and gravel and mulch or doing any construction work, to get just a pickup truck. And one of those trucks with the lift, where they're much higher off the ground and they're much bigger, with the off-road tires, but they don't do anything. As the lady said, they don't do anything but go to the grocery store and go back home. And it's all about, you know, how loud they are and how fast they can pick up. And my friend, he recently just bought one of those same type trucks. And he does work, but I don't think that he needed this size of pickup truck. But anyway, so I rode in it, and it goes really, really fast, like faster than, you know, an average sedan that I've been in. These trucks get, they pick up speed very quickly. And they require a lot of energy to stop. And the trucks are everywhere down here. Like, everybody drives a truck. Everybody. So, with that, I'll end it.
That's, I think, a part of that whole, I've never lived in South Carolina, but a part of that whole toxic masculinity gun culture, I think, get your big truck and hunting and all that and run up and down the road making noise and all the rest of it. I think that's a big part of that. I can't even say Southern culture, because they do that at Washington State. They do that out here. They got more going on than Bill Gates and Starbucks. There's quite a bit of rural Washington where you get your big truck and Confederate flag and have the gun rack and a lot of that out these parts too. But I mean, yeah, that's like, she has graphics, images in the book where she talks about how, it's just science. The bigger the vehicle, much greater likelihood for a fatal injury if there is a collision with a pedestrian. And particularly she talked to them having them raised higher. Whereas if you think like a normal, like sedan or whatever it is, it strikes you, the bumper would hit your legs for most folks. Typical height of person, male or female, the bumper would be hitting you somewhere on your legs, knees, shin, somewhere in that region. You're talking these trucks, for some folks, it's hitting you like chest level, vital organs level, like a much greater likelihood for a fatality, serious injury. It could even be head level, especially if we're talking children. Those vehicles are up so high, in addition to their obscuring your vision, you know, if you have someone who's shorter or someone who's in a wheelchair, disabled. But bigger and faster, the speed that she was talking about, she talks about that a lot in the book, and saying, hey, let's just make a commitment to slowing down. And I mean, hey, I understand lots of people are in a rush, but in my view, that is a big part of white supremacy culture. I believe that's in Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, where she talks about this concept of time and rushing and constantly being against the clock and on the clock, and we gotta be in a hurry and go, 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 and go faster and go faster. And she said, all this horsepower, that's a big part of the selling point. If we can go fast, we can accelerate, like boom, you can go 0 to 60 in, you know, a millisecond. What is all that for? And particularly, she said,
it's not like you're going off-road. Are you going out in the mud sometime today? Really? You going to pull somebody who's stuck in the creek? Really? You're going to Target. You're going to Costco. You could do some shopping. You do not need all of that just to go to the grocery store. Feed your family. Get yourself to and from work. What is all of that for? I love the portion. She said, might have to fight one of these Negroes going to the grocery store. Like, man, we got to have all these deaths and everything on the street just because of your commitment to white supremacy, racism, and all that go back. White genetic annihilation. Penis envy and all that from the white genetic annihilation and the aging population. I'm sure it's going to be a lot more of that as you have this graying older white people in this part of the world. Like, ooh, even more to soup up the masculinity of whites. Anyway, I'd be very much about the safety component because it's just something that I hadn't thought about. If that means anything that you can do to encourage people in your area about safety, some I've seen where she talks about in the book, people getting campaigns and things together to get crosswalks, stop signs, speed bumps, bike lanes, all kinds. And some of this stuff is meager. It's not, these are not things that would break the budget to get someone to come out with a pan of paint and put a crosswalk down. Speed limits, now that can be different. You probably have to get some powerful white people to change the speed limit. Another one that she talked about. But crosswalks, speed bumps, some of those things, you can get things done just making people aware. I'm torn. I would tell people to read this book because it does have a lot of constructive information, but she's also practicing racism, white supremacy in specific ways, I also think. So study racism, white supremacy, and read this book as well. That'll be a part of your study of racism. Maybe listen to this broadcast as well so you can hear her be questioned with suspicion. I suspect she's not accustomed to being questioned in the manner that she was here when she speaks with other victims of racism. They just sing her. Did you hear that when I read at the very beginning in the book? I hope I said what is written. The foreword is written by Charles T. Brown. He said, one thing, well, make sure I read the right one. Mr. Brown, he said, at the nexus of this unwavering fight for justice and truth telling is the genesis of my appreciation and admiration for my dear sister, Amy Schmidt. I have always known my sister. Now, he had to call her sister twice. Like, wow. I don't like people calling me brother at all. Like, he had to call this white person sister two times. Like, I don't know. Sister Schmidt didn't impress me too much. But anywho, everybody satisfied? Anything else they need to get in?
Hello.
Our caller in Georgia. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. I guess, did she say that one of her teachers was black and was well known, but she didn't remember what their name was? Did she say that?
Good memory. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I think that's weird, because if the person was well-known, it seemed like she would know what their name was. I mean, who was this person well-known to? I mean, not that I have the greatest memory, but I remember my teachers. I remember almost all of them. Even if I remember my name, I saw a picture, I'm like, yep, that's it. That's him. That's her. And if this is like her major, this person was well-known, seems like she would have known who that is. But I guess, you know, when you are, you know, I guess that's his privilege. I think he said it was him. His black male privilege, I guess. Maybe I should have sprinkled some black girl magic through the phone. Help him remember. I don't know.
Black male privilege. And check that out. You are well known in the field. Can't even remember your name. Black male privilege. Black male privilege. It's been a decade. Like, hey, I couldn't remember that Marta goes to Lenox Mall, although it has been substantially more than 10 years since I lived in Atlanta. But I did forget that Marta goes to Lenox Mall. So, you know, everybody's memory isn't as good. But, yeah, prestigious black male professor. Unidentified, limited in the field. Can't be too many of them in the traffic division, urban planning. I mean, It's not like it's overrun with the Negro male. Oh, well, maybe we'll get his name down the road. Let's see. Anything else folks need to get in? Heard a few folks. Let's see. Was that our caller in California, maybe? I heard non-Clemson grad, too, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get both of you. Caller in California, you can go first, I guess.
This dialogue brings to memory one of the Black Panther movies I saw in middle school, where in the very beginning, a black child gets ran over, and that's kind of what prompts the movie. And I'm like, this is a pattern. Having black children killed by vehicles in film is a racist pattern, I suspect. I just wanted to chime that in.
That's Mario Van Peebles' Panther. I thought of that while I was out at the Ballard Locks today, prepping for the program. That is the opening scene. I think Kadeem Hardison is there. I haven't seen that film in a long time, but I think that's the opening montage where he's at the intersection and a young black child has been ran over. He's on his bike at the intersection. There is no crosswalk, but she points out in the book that all intersections, marked or not, are legal crosswalks. Whether it's marked or not, you're supposed to yield to pedestrians. That is a legal right-of-way for them to cross there. And she says that frequently people either don't understand this law or they lie about it or whatever. And they'll say, oh, it was no crosswalk. So he didn't cross an illegal crossway. Up, got what he deserved. Should have been paying attention. Should have crossed in the crosswalk. And all intersections are legal crosswalks, marked or no. Again, now, that doesn't mean, you know, system of white supremacy. Let's see. Non-Clemson grad? Yes, sir.
So two things on the safety part, right? So obviously, Gus, you said Seattle's one of the most walkable cities that you've ever lived in or ever been in. One of the reasons why that's true outside of just simply banning black people is because of the length of the blocks in Seattle. I believe they're 250 feet long by 250 feet, which is a little bit longer than a place like Portland, which is 200 feet by 200 feet. By definition, that's a very short distance to get to the next crosswalk. So, of course, you're going to see a whole lot more crosswalks in a place like Seattle or Portland compared to other places around the country where the blocks are really, really long, which means people have to go a really long distance before they can get to a crosswalk and cross the street. This is potentially better than somewhere like New York City where I grew up, where, of course, New York City is considered to be one of the most walkable places in the entire country. But blocks are much longer in New York City, depending on where you are. Like Manhattan, I think it's like 60 feet by like 600 feet and 800 feet, feet in some places. So that's why Seattle is so walkable compared to most other cities you might have lived in. And then on the safety punch up front, ironically enough, Chuck Marone, who we've invited to come on the show and has declined. When it comes to, because he's an engineer, one of the things he said when it comes to safety is, you know, how do you talk to engineers about the values of what you want your streets to function like? When engineers build, they think about speed, capacity, cost, safety, and people. That's usually for people who are driving. But when you talk about the people outside of vehicles who might not be driving, people who might be walking or riding a bike or something like that, obviously your first concern is absolutely safety because you're vulnerable to heavy vehicles and fast-moving traffic. So, for example, one of the things he put out an article, I think about 2 days ago, that specifically said that, for example, engineers specifically know how to make traffic move faster. A couple of the ways they go about this is they have wide lanes. Like, you know, instead of 10-foot narrow lanes, they might have 12-foot lanes like you see on highways or interstates, which facilitates fast traffic. Another thing is that something called the clear zone, which means no trees, no unmovable objects. So if someone runs off the road, you know, they have a little bit of time to recover. But, you know, obviously when you get into urban places where people might be walking or riding a bike, a vehicle is going fast and they go off the road, well, shoot, a person or a person riding a bike is not an immovable object. And like my wife said, a lady got pinned up against a tree. Obviously the tree is very, very unlikely to move. And part of that, this is interesting too, because there was another article, I think, in City Lab that talked about the idea, not an abstract one too. He talked about the idea of removable posts. So, for example, they engineers clearly understand that vehicles constantly, always run off the road for whatever reason, whether someone's not paying attention, whether someone is intoxicated, whatever the reason might be, they might run off the road. And because they might run off the road, things like, let's say, lamp posts or bollards, you know, things, you know, some kind of post figure, the way that they're fastened into the ground is that if they are struck by a vehicle, they are meant to break away so that the car is not brought to an abrupt stop, causing injury to the person who might be inside the vehicle. The problem with this is that it's great for the people inside the vehicle, but imagine if a car runs up a road and that immovable thing is now, you know, it's movable, that car's kinetic energy is going to continue to move, and anyone behind some kind of post that's movable has the potential to be harmed and or killed. And this is the kind of stuff people need to start bringing up to engineers when they put in their projects in their neighborhoods. Okay, cool. I understand that you're trying to protect people in the vehicle when the driver makes a mistake that could, you know, cause harm. But who are you going to protect more in this situation? Are you going to try to make it so that you protect the people in the vehicle? Which means that you put those, you know, those movable objects that'll break away when someone runs off the road, or you put the objects that don't break away so that when someone runs off the vehicle, yeah, someone might crash. They might hit an object. They might die. But at the very least, the person behind the object is not going to be killed. They'll be potentially protected from the moving vehicle because they are most vulnerable. And I'll leave it at that.
Fascinating. Just where the priorities are in terms of protection. And do we even think, hey, there might actually be pedestrians hanging out in this area? Are they considered their safety, or are we just thinking about let's go as fast as that's what Amy Schmidt, she seems to suggest in her book. A lot of this is just emphasis on speed for white people. That's the way I'm stating it. She didn't put white people, but I mean speed for white people. I want to get in my SUV and go as fast as I can. Speed for white people. And especially over the pandemic, the reckless driving on the road, we talked about that, people getting out and drag racing and going 100 miles an hour and all that nonsense. I'm going to go as fast as I can, get in my souped up vehicle and see what this baby can do. Do you have that? Is that facilitated in your planning? She said the whole in the United States that is facilitated, like the way that the roads are constructed. It is about that speed. Let's go as fast as we can. It doesn't have to be that way. She talked about other white countries, Norway, Sweden, even the city of London, Canada, she mentioned, where she said, hey, you can design things differently where it's we will emphasize safety for pedestrians. Maybe this will be a no car zone. Talking about that in several. I think they're talking about that for here in downtown Seattle at some point, like maybe 10, 20, might even be 25 years down the road, but making portions of downtown like no cars. I would love downtown Seattle if there were no cars. I hate being downtown. I feel like that's one area where you could totally die at because they have really bad congestion. You can't go fast, but it's just the traffic is bad. And whew, I would love it if that was a no car zone. And I think they are even the area where the Ferris wheel is. That's downtown where the pier is. I think that was an area where cars used to drive through. I think they removed all of that and they're going to make that a walk area. So there's no cars. Huge thumbs up for that. Now you can just walk by the pier and not have fear of dying and someone pinning you next to a tree. And all of that, in my opinion, is not done that way in the U.S. because they have such a high population of black people. And according to reports, growing population of non-white people, they're not going to do that in large part, I would say. It's not an infrastructure thing, although that's what it is, but it's a white supremacy thing. We're not interested in preserving non-white walkers. Daryl Deadman ran that nigger over. If it's predominantly white cities where they want to do their bike lanes and be green, Seattle, Portland, sure there are other places, absolutely. But in the areas where you got black, Detroit, with apparent South Carolina, lots of black people down there. 4-lane highway, run for your life. She talked about that all throughout the book. Right of way. Road racism, that's the hashtag I used. That we didn't even talk about that, all the incidents of white people threatening to shoot black people on the road and all the rest of it. Dedicated, intentional, and deliberate. Racist man, racist woman, racist child in all areas of people activity. You should think about that when people talk about racism, white supremacy. It's not just a Klan member and someone calling you a nigger. It's the people, the urban planners who are responsible for your black neighborhood not having a sidewalk and a crosswalk. Speed limits being 35 miles per hour there instead of 20. That is racism, white supremacy too, and has quite a bit of blood on it. Non-white peoples. Black male privilege too. Everybody good? We finished? Grand at minimum will be here on Thursday. Check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook page for other updates. Again, much obliged, non-Clemson grad, recommending the book Right of Way, Reading More Important Than Watching Television. We'll see. If I don't die today, I'll make sure I get some of my pictures from my outings in Seattle. I went to the beach yesterday, went to the Ballard Locks today. Whew. Amazing. Wow. Just amazing. And especially even today at the Locks, that is a product of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Shout to Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure. But the very same U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, that is one of their products. The infamous Ballard Locks. It's a tourist attraction. I went today for the first time. I was stunned. I can see why. Yet another tourist attraction in the great plantation of Seattle. Sobriety would be best. I can't say it enough. That was in so many of the reports where these black people, black children sometimes, who were killed and mangled. People under, as he said, people go off the road for lots of reasons. Maybe they're tired. Maybe they're intoxicated. Many, many reasons to emphasize sobriety would be best. Heaven help us if you happen to be a pedestrian and have had a drink as opposed to getting in a vehicle and drunk driving. I'll just walk home. And then you get hit. Oh, he was jaywalking and drunk. You know, he certainly deserved what he got. In addition to being sober, if you're going to go out, you see folks being hostile and loud, I would not confront them. There are lots of armed individuals right now. And people are not very stable. If someone is being threatening, I would exit. You have no idea if that person is armed. You have no idea if that person has an entourage with firearms. In addition to being sober, if you are in a vehicle going out and about, if you're driving, you're not on a cell phone, whew, pay attention for pedestrians. And we need all of our attention to be mindful of our surroundings, doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. No name calling. That is, man, simple one we can do. No name calling, no gossiping, minimizing conflict with other victims of racism. Really at the top of our priority list for solving this problem. Right up there with eating well, getting exercise. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.